Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. The felines and I crawled up out of the command bunker tonight to check out the balmy October desert sky. Feels kind of like Maui this time of year here in Las Vegas, minus the ocean, of course. Got so much to talk about tonight and two great guests here to help us process some fairly dramatic events that have come bubbling to the surface of late. On my calendar, this is the Sunday I had marked for the last several months, written in bold letters, Tom DeLonge Sunday. It's the date we plan to have rock star entrepreneur Tom DeLonge on the show to talk about the next stage in his ambitious plans, where things go from here, talk to key members of his team as well. Figured it would come right after his announcement. That date has changed a couple of times, as you know. We changed with it. Well, we learned 2 weeks ago on the same day he made his announcement on a stage in Seattle that he would not be able to do any interviews for a while. As many of you know, Tom DeLonge announced the creation of his To the Stars Academy, which is governed by the rules of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and his lawyers advised him that he and his board members should not do any broadcast interviews, meaning no TV or radio, so not while this public offering process is underway. If you watched the announcement event or watched a rebroadcast online, you know there were no reporters present. It wasn't a news conference. And since the announcement, of course, people have been anything but shy in expressing their opinions about what unfolded that day. And, you know, I feel the same way you do about it. I really wish we had Tom and his team here with us. There's so much to talk about, so many questions to ask, but that is not the case. If you've heard his earlier interviews, you know, Tom is not a shrinking violet. He's not shy. He's very open to speaking about his projects and interests, and I know he'd like to be able to speak in detail, especially right now. He needs to get the word out there, but it is what it is, so we move on. There is still a heck of a lot of news to cover, and that's what we're going to do tonight. If I had told you a year ago or 2 years ago that in October of 2017, a group of five insiders, men with the highest security clearances in our government, who'd been at the pinnacle of military and intelligence agencies of power in this country, would step forward on a stage and announce, among other things, that the study of UFOs never stopped with Project Blue Book, that in fact the military has continued to collect UFO information and analyze it as a potential threat, that our government has studied the technology of UFO craft, trying to figure out how to duplicate these amazing abilities, that the government's collected striking films and videos and photos of UFOs, and I'm talking about clear daylight images, not these fuzzy nighttime cell phone shots, that our satellite systems and radars have detected UFOs, that the government takes this very seriously, that it's real. The UFO phenomenon is real, that one of the men on that stage had been in charge of the UFO data program and threat assessment for the Secretary of Defense that he worked directly, served with, was friends with, Secretary of Defense James Mattis, General Mattis. That others had also worked for the Secretary of Defense in intelligence capacities, that one of the men, who is now saying UFOs are real, has been a 30-year CIA professional who gave daily briefings to the President of the United States, and another who worked on classified technology programs for multiple three-letter agencies for decades, that one was a brilliant engineer who's worked on the most top-secret platforms in the U.S. arsenal, and that all of these men were putting their reputations on the line to say it's all true. You would have considered that to be an historic day. Well, it happened. It happened this month. That and more. It happened in October this month. But you wouldn't know it if you read major newspapers or watched network news programs. The UFO community, the poobahs of the flying saucer realm, reacted as if someone just kicked their mom in the ribs. Well, tonight we're going to talk about what was revealed at the event in Seattle, what it means. Leslie Kane is the journalist who reported about the Tom DeLonge announcement the day before it happened. Her story filled in the broad strokes of what would unfold, what people should watch for, and outlined what was likely to happen. And then she wrote a follow-up after that event. And based on her many years of chasing the UFO story, the UFO reality, she considered that to be a landmark day, a hugely important news story. She's had some time to digest the events and the reaction. And Leslie joins me in a few minutes to separate wheat from chaff and to address some of the questions many of you have been asking about this undertaking. The other dramatic news from that day involved a vivid example of what our military has been dealing with for the last 60-plus years, a well-documented, clear daylight encounter between the U.S. Navy and a gigantic Tic Tac, for lack of a better term. This UFO had been popping up in and around this battle group of the USS Nimitz, a warship, one of the most powerful and most sophisticated in the world. Fighter planes were sent out. Images were recorded. The technology displayed by this big Tic Tac thing was far beyond anything that we have. There was an intense investigation, more than one, in fact. And like so many other solid UFO cases, this file got stuck in a desk somewhere, and everyone pretended like it never happened. I know that a civilian agency, one of those three-letter outfits, looked into it. And then a few years later, another group started its own investigation outside the purview of government. Then an article appeared in an aviation magazine, one that's read by pilots, written by pilots. Until Tom DeLonge's Seattle event, the only other public discussion about the Tic Tac UFO was on this program, when I interviewed filmmaker Jeremy Corbell, who has developed his own sources and new information about this incident, which we will get to an hour from now when Jeremy returns to the program. The fact that a former intelligence official high in the Department of Defense would not only acknowledge this case, but add new details to it in a public forum, vouch for it, and then use the case to challenge Congress to launch its own inquiry is, I would say, news. It's news. If I told you a year ago that this would happen, I'm not sure you would have believed me. We're going to talk to Jeremy about the 2004 Tic Tac incident and more recent encounters with the very same craft, and some other surprises, including his film, Patient 17, which is about alien implant surgeries performed by the late Dr. Roger Lear. Maybe even a Bob Lazar sighting, a new interview. Who knows? We have a lot of ground to cover, as I mentioned, so, you know, let's get to it. Webmaster Lex Lonehood and I have culled together items and oddities from around the world. We call it Naps News. You can find it on the Coast website. Among the stories tonight, a new account of the Tic Tac UFO posted Friday on Facebook. It includes a link to the original leaked document, which was incorporated into that aviation article I referenced a couple of minutes ago. More about the documents and the validity of that later. Also, if you're wondering why we haven't made contact with aliens, we've got a story about confirmable contact, I should say, but got a story, a science article about the impact of icy worlds. Blame it on Hoth, I guess you could say. Also, a really interesting story about the Bradshaw Ranch near Sedona in Arizona, where a lot of the same kind of weird stuff occurs as at the better-known Skinwalker Ranch in Utah. And with Halloween on the way, a story about the origins of some of our strangest Halloween holiday customs. That and more in Naps News. While you're there, check out how to become a Coast Insider. Costs you about 15 cents a day. Gives you access to a vast archive of previous programs. You can listen to them anytime you want, as often as you want, on just about any format. Coast Insider is still a great deal. You can also find out how to subscribe to George Norrie's TV show, Beyond Belief, which covers a lot of the same ground that we cover on this program. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and cat, put on a pot of mud, slip into those silky jammies, try on those bunny slippers, and plop down in the Barca lounger. Turn down the lights and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, Leslie Kane, I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. To prepare for tonight's program, I sort of look back to refresh my memory about Tom DeLonge's history on Coast to Coast. And in a way, you and I have had a front row seat for how his projects have evolved over the last 6 years or so. His first big public interview about his interest in UFOs was right here on Coast back in December 2011. Then he returned in 2014. He talked about personal experiences he had had in the interim. Then in March of 2016, He came here to tell us about government contacts he'd made, insiders who were telling him things about the UFO mystery, and many of you didn't believe him. And it's right to ask questions about this. I mean, why would insiders talk to a rock star, many of you asked, as I did? Then the WikiLeaks thing exploded that same year, a couple months after he was here. We found out he really had been talking to well-placed people on the inside, generals and such. And he had a plan in mind to give those insiders a way to get information out into the sunlight. Those plans changed with the WikiLeaks revelations. But by February of this year, Tom DeLonge was back on Coast, and at that point he said the program he was working on would be different than what he originally had in mind, but he was moving forward with a process that would achieve the same thing. It would take place over a couple of years. And a lot of people decided that Tom meant by that that he was going to announce UFO disclosure with a capital D. I know that several hundred of you have written emails to me to that effect, and no matter how many times their attempts have been made to sort of temper those expectations, that is still what was expected. If disclosure means the president comes out and announces UFOs are real and he opens up an ice box holding the Roswell dead alien, then no, that didn't happen. But given the pedigree of the people who were with Tom earlier this month, I'd say it's a major development. The ball has been moved down the field. Leslie Kane is a veteran journalist and has been my guest on this program to talk about two terrific books she's written. One focused on the UFO subject and about the major players inside government who take it seriously. The other about the survival of consciousness after death. Her stories about Tom DeLonge's announcement generated national attention when they were published by the Huffington Post, still generating reactions, I should say. She agreed to come back for this first hour tonight to share some thoughts and reactions to what's unfolded. Leslie, thanks for doing this.
Hey, George. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Share with me a little bit about the briefing that you had where this all unfolded and your reaction to it then and your reaction now that the stories came out.
Well, the briefing you're referring to was about exactly 1 week before the release date, which was October 11th. And, you know, the team just wanted to have some really good coverage of this. And I knew two of the team members. I've known Chris Mellon and Hal Puthoff for quite a while. So they invited me to come down to Washington. I met with Hal Puthoff and Jim Semivan, who I'd hadn't met before. Lou Elizondo and Chris Mellon was there as well. And it was a four-hour meeting. And the real interesting part for me, of course, was Lou Elizondo, because this man had literally resigned from his position at the Department of Defense literally the day before I met him. And as you alluded to earlier, he headed up the DOD program, which investigates what they call aerial threats. And within the study of aerial threats, they investigated UFOs. And here we had the head of a government program coming forward and acknowledging that he headed up that program, that the program exists, and that as a result of that, the conclusion is that the phenomenon is real, that there's no doubt about that. And so at that meeting, I got to know him quite as well as you can get to know someone in 4 hours. And what was really important about it was that he was able to verify for me through documents and various things that he showed me that he indeed is who he says he is, that his job was indeed what he says it was. And he was very concerned that he provide that documentation for me, that he wanted to make it absolutely clear to me who he was and what he did. And that was entirely fascinating to me. And I came away from that meeting after speaking with these guys for 4 hours, very, very excited about what they're doing and interested in reporting on it. Because as you said earlier, George, I believe this is a big story and I think it's really important. So that was the value of the meeting for me, was really to just begin the process of getting enough background to be able to cover it, during the week just before the event, and then the same day another story came out. So
I know you've been down this road before. I mean, your book was UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. So you know there are people inside government, not the government. We can't, say it's one big megalithic entity or something, but monolithic entity. But you know that there are people who take it seriously. But this was a real step forward because this guy confirms, we've been studying it the whole time. It didn't end with Project Blue Book. That seems to me to be a pretty significant news story.
I completely agree with you, and I think you're right. You know, I have had a lot of experience dealing with these types of people, but many of them that I dealt with, George, were from other countries, you know, very high levels, but nonetheless, there weren't that many Americans that I was able to bring forward in that book, because most of them work behind the scenes and sort of in the shadows. And I think that's what's so phenomenal about what's happening right now, is that these high-level, very key people are coming out of the shadows. They're stepping forward into the public arena. They're keeping their connections to government, which are very important, or to the various agencies that they worked with, but they're still independent. So there's a bridge now between this independent public company and the government, which is really important. And they're coming forward for basically the first time. At least they are in a new way, in a way that they've never come forward before. And Elizondo, of course, is coming forward for the first time. So even though I have talked to people before in high levels, this is something to me that's unprecedented in terms of the American situation. And as you said, it counters the official line that has been set up ever since Project Blue Book closed, which is that the government's not interested in this and we don't investigate it. Now we know that's not true.
What's the reaction been, public reaction and media reaction to the stories? You wrote two stories, that one which outlined what was to come, and then another story after the announcement that largely focused on Lou Elizondo and Chris Mellon and their stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the stories got picked up a lot over the internet, George, but, you know, I'm never happy with the fact that the mainstream media, the big guys, don't grab it. And I think it's a huge story, but it hasn't kind of broken into, you know, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, New York Times, Washington Post. That type of media hasn't covered it yet. I think they will, because more is going to come out. There are going to be some more very interesting things that are going to come out. And at some point, I think the major media will grab it. But I think it's gotten a lot of play. There have been a mixture of responses, certainly in the media, but I think a lot of the public have had, as you mentioned, a lot of questions. Many of them are critical of the organization for various reasons. And I have been somewhat surprised about the intense negativity that I think is out there. But nonetheless, I'm a journalist and I'm going to keep covering it. And I think, you know, as I said, I think it's really worthy of coverage. And I think you would agree that this is something important. And positive, very positive.
Chris Mellon used the example of the Tic Tac UFO incident. We're going to talk about that later as well. If you want to talk about it now, that's good too. I mean, as a direct challenge to Congress. I mean, he worked for the Senate Intelligence Committee for years, had high clearances, oversaw all kinds of black programs. He knows those people, and he was directly challenging Congress. Look, if you don't know about this technology, about this incident, you need to have a briefing. And I thought that incident, that those statements by him were not only should be taken literally, but also you could read between the lines, suggesting that maybe there is going to be congressional interest in this sort of thing, at least behind the scenes.
Yeah, I think it's he just sort of feels like that case. And I don't want to go into that case now because I really don't know it that well. And I know you're going to have an expert come on soon. But, you know, was it a very important incident that took place around the aircraft carrier where there's a tremendous sightings in broad daylight seen by many, many witnesses and picked up on radar, two different radars. And I think, you know, Chris Mellon really sees this as a potential catalyst, this particular case. And all it takes is one or two members of Congress to request a briefing on it. It doesn't, you know, completely privately. But once a member of Congress is interested and gets briefed on it, then he believes that could escalate, that could build, and others will become interested in it. So he sort of is hoping this will be something that will open a door, and he's going to try to make that happen.
I've had the conversation with Tom DeLonge about tempering expectations a bunch of times, and I know people had it in their mind this was going to be something else. I don't know what the something else is, but as I said, I thought this does move the ball down the field quite a bit. Did you get a sense that there is a lot more to come, that this was just sort of to set up the infrastructure of what comes next?
Definitely. I think there's more to come, and they have announced that themselves. First of all, that they're going to be releasing videos taken with top-notch military cameras that they, as you mentioned, are not just fuzzy images taken with cell phones, but really, really technologically advanced cameras. And these videos have been, you know, declassified and all provided legally through Lou Elizondo when he was at the Department of Defense. And I think this is going to be something that's really going to be important when they're right now setting up the mechanism through which they can release those videos. It's not a simple process, but it's certainly going to happen, and I think that's going to be a big deal. And there will be other documents and other information that they intend to bring forward as time goes on. They will also be letting people know about things that happen, various meetings that they're going to have, events that are going to take place that they're involved with. To the extent that they can make these things public, they are absolutely committed to doing that.
We're talking with Leslie Kane about the announcement of To the Stars Academy made by Tom DeLonge and his group. When we come back, we'll talk about a couple of other members of the team, Steve Justice, who just came over from Skunk Works, Hal Putoff, and Jim Semivan. We're talking with Leslie Kane about the To the Stars Academy announcement made by Tom DeLonge and his team of inside advisors. When we come back, we'll get into the financing, which has raised a lot of questions and concerns out there among the public. And I think Leslie can help address some of those questions. We'll be right back. Leslie Kane, in a moment, we'll jump into the financial stuff. And I know it's sort of tricky for us to deal with it because we're not directly involved, but we'll get to it in a second. Before I leave the public reaction to it, though, the reaction of the ufology poobahs, the high priests of ufology, is not surprising to me at all. I don't know if it surprised you, but I've been in it 30 years now. And, you know, this activity is characterized by backbiting and infighting and turf wars. It's a nasty little business. The only thing that unites the high priests of ufology is when somebody comes from outside their circle with a new source of information. Then they circle the wagons and they sharpen their claws. And man, they have gone after Tom DeLonge. He knew that this would happen. I mean, he knew it, you know, a couple of years ago, and was trying to shoot for a larger audience beyond that UFO group. But tell me this, are you surprised by the vitriol?
I'm surprised, George, but, you know, I don't have my finger sort of plugged into that world as much as you do. I mean, as you say, you've been covering it for 30 years, and I think you follow the events of the UFO community a lot more closely than I do. So I'm really more outside of the whole thing, so therefore I'm more surprised because you've had more experience with it than I have. So I think, you know, I think people have every right to ask questions. People have raised some good questions, but I am surprised by the sort of hostility, the negativity, and the jumping to conclusions that people think after this one event that it's all about raising money or this and that, and they don't really think carefully and read carefully, I don't think, before drawing conclusions, and that disturbs me.
I know that there's 100 people have sent me this video that's on YouTube that just rakes me over the coals, too, for not getting into the finances, which I'm not sure that these internet journalists understand what a TV guy's job is, but I have a 3-minute window to tell the news of what happened on the day of that announcement, and I thought the news was about UFOs. I think the financial stuff is definitely, you need to explore it. I would not urge somebody, it would be inappropriate for me or for you to tell people, put your money into this. We don't know what people's finances are. And we don't know all the intricacies of how this thing works. So I would not advise people to do this. I wouldn't give them advice either way. You know, you look at the information that they're posting. But I've seen stuff that's posted that's just ridiculous. You know, it's about DeLonge and his motives. I mean, he had a company. He could have kept this whole thing to himself. He had all the intellectual properties that he'd already put like $1.5 million, $2 million into developing that will become big projects. He rolled it into what will become a public company and didn't have to. And I don't know if you understand sort of any of the intricacies of how this thing works, but it doesn't look to me like DeLonge is ripping off the public. It doesn't look like that at all.
You know, and George, I think I'm just sort of beginning to look into that aspect of it because, like you, the interesting part to me was the UFO story, what this meant, who the people were, what they were saying. I wasn't particularly interested in exploring the financial structure of the organization or what they were asking of their investors because that's not the part that concerned me. But as a journalist, I also understand that people want information about that as well. I have approached members of the team about that literally today. I had discussions with them about that. They are going to put on the website very soon some clarifying information that I think will help address the concerns that people have raised. And they're aware of what those concerns are. They're not hiding anything. They very much want to explain things to people, and that's going to happen. And I just think it's better that people hear it directly from the company than hearing it from you and me sort of trying to figure it out. But, you know, if they can go directly, and they're going to be able to do that. I think a lot of the concern had to do with a loan that Tom DeLonge had provided. As you said, he put, you know, $1.5 million, $2 million of his own money into this. And, you know, there was some misunderstanding about how quickly that loan was going to be paid back. And it was going to be a huge chunk. It's really not going to be a big chunk. It's going to be paid back slowly. And I think that's something that needs to be clarified by the members of the company. And they are going to clarify that. So I just want people to kind of stay abreast of that. And I will be posting on my Facebook page a link when they do put some new information up. So I think that'll help clear things up a lot for people.
I think a legitimate question, too, that was raised by a lot of people is about the cost of what Steve Justice talked about. Steve Justice was the head of advanced projects for the Skunk Works, Lockheed Martin Skunk Works, which has developed amazing technology over the last 50 years or so, including a lot of stuff tested here at Nevada's Area 51. But he's talking about this amazing craft. Reading between the lines, it sounds like something that maybe the black world has already built based on technology they got from somewhere else. But he's talking about building this craft that might take billions of dollars to develop. And clearly these guys are not going to raise that kind of money. So again, reading between the lines, it sounds like they're going to have to partner with some folks.
Exactly. And Tom actually told me today that is exactly what they have in mind. The aerospace part of the project is going to be a little bit later. You know, they're initially going to get other things rolling. And they do intend to partner. They do intend to get contracts with major aerospace companies, even with the U.S. government. They'll get grants. They'll work with they'll get contracts from companies and government agencies that have the money for this. And that's how everybody does it. That's how the aerospace business works. You can't possibly raise the money yourself or something like that. But it can be done if they partner with the right people. And it looks like already there's some interest from some very important and I know one big aerospace company anyway is already expressing interest in working with them. So it just takes time for this all to develop. But it's conceivable that they could do that. And people have to understand that it's not just they're not planning to crowdfund to get money for that. You know, that's something that will take time and will happen over the long term. And it will depend on partnering with outside entities that can help support it.
You know, the other there's another issue that's come up ever since Tom came onto the scene. It's about disinformation. Well, clearly he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's being led by the nose. This will be disinformation. Whatever he gets will be fed to him, and it's stuff they want out to divert attention away from blah, blah, blah. That is a legitimate concern because in this field, as you know, Leslie, there's been some people have come forward with totally bogus stuff. They've spied on UFO researchers and infiltrated UFO groups, and you have to be on the alert for that kind of thing. The thing is about the group of people that he brought forward, I don't see them fitting into that category.
I mean, I would agree, George. And again, you know more about that than I do, but I would agree with you. I mean, I've known Hal Puthoff, as an example, for a long time, and there's absolutely no way that I could see him being part of anything like that. And I don't get that sense of the others just because of the high-level people that they are. And I really do believe, George, that they have a very genuine motivation and intention to do this for the right reasons, for the same reasons that all of us have, which is we want to understand what this phenomenon is about, and we want to be able to harness the technology for the good of the planet. And I have never had any sense from any of these people that there's anything other than that motivates them to want to do this. So I would find it hard to believe that, you know, and also their credentials and everything is documented. I mean, they're not sort of shady characters that are, you know, spreading disinformation through leaked documents and things like that. Everything is above board with them.
Well, at this stage of their lives, too, I'm not sure any of them need to have their names tarnished. They spent their adult lives in the service of their country and honorable service of their country. Chris Mellon comes from one of the wealthiest families in the world. I don't think he needs the dough. Jim Semivan, 25 or 30 years with the CIA, the clandestine service. One of the quotes in an article I saw from him, it said, you know, a lot of people in our group are former government employees who know the stuff is going on. When it comes to UAPs, which is their term for UFOs, we feel there is something to it. And people in the government and people anywhere, some have had unexplainable experiences. Others are curious. He's a person who's had an unexplainable experience, right?
Absolutely. And I think it's just terrific that he has had the courage to actually write about that and speak out about it. And I think that all the people out there who are experiencers and feel like they may have been marginalized, you know, from sort of the higher level people that are dealing with this topic, it's not going to be true with this group. They are conscious of the whole realm of the experiencer world. At least one of their members, as you said, is an experiencer himself and has spoken out about it. So I think that's another wonderful thing about this group, is that it's opened up to that realm, and it recognizes how little we really understand about what this phenomenon actually is, how complicated it is, and, you know, just something way vaster and more complicated than we really understand. And Jim Semivan knows that better than anybody, because he's actually had a direct experience himself. So that's true. There you are. I don't think someone like Jim Semivan is out to spread disinformation when he's been humble enough to talk about his own personal experience that he said changed his life.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with being on edge and being of a position where, all right, show me what you got. You know, they've talked about having films and access to the things that are either unclassified or going to be declassified and released to them. I've heard the same sort of behind the scene whispers that you have, that maybe they already have some of this stuff. They're going to release it, but I think people have a right to say, okay, show me and verify it. It makes sense to go ahead and check it. If the stuff is true, if it's legit, then it should be treated as such.
Absolutely, and I think people have every right to ask, too, well, if you have this stuff, why aren't you showing it to us now? I think people were disappointed, as you mentioned, that the launch didn't include, like you mentioned, you know, the alien body, but even that it didn't include any videos, say. And I just think, you know, people have to understand that, and I learned this when I met with them, that there's a real process involved with releasing those videos. It's not simple, but they have them, and it's going to happen. And I have every confidence in that. And so I think it's just a matter of people having patience, and they'll see those videos. And when they're released, they are going to include documentation that show the chain of custody of those videos, that document where they came from, how they were declassified, if they were declassified, what the process was. All of that will be documented, so there'll be no question as to the veracity, you know, the authenticity of these videos, and that they actually are what they're being told, what they're saying they are is the real deal. So it's all going to be provided, and it's very hard to wait, you know, when you've been waiting for so long, and Tom gets very enthusiastic, and people get very excited, and they have high expectations, but I think things will evolve and people will be very pleased with what will come. I mean, I don't know a lot more about that than anyone else, but I've talked to the people involved, and that gives me confidence that they're telling the truth about what they have, and that they are going to bring these things out.
Tom's enthusiasm has sort of caused him problems, you know, and he's done it on this show and in interviews that I've done, and probably with you as well. And he does, he gets pretty enthused and has been advised to temper expectations, and I think he's had to do that over the last 2 years because of events that unfolded. He's had to tone it down a little bit and realize it's not going to all happen in one day. It's got to be over a length of time. At least that's what he's told me. Why do you suppose these other guys came forward now? Why'd they do it?
Well, I mean, you know, I think because, first of all, Tom has been sort of talking to them behind the scenes for a year or two at least. And it just seemed like the circumstances came together. A number of them were retiring now anyway. I mean, they didn't just leave their jobs to do this. It just so happened that they were about to retire. I know Steve Justice was about to retire. Lou Elizondo was about to retire. And they just had a bunch of meetings for the last year or two, and it just seemed to sort of gel at this time. So, you know, and there was this entity, there was this company through which they could all come, you know, there's an umbrella for them to gather under, and that didn't exist before. So, I think there's just been momentum building up. I mean, I don't know if you agree, George, but there's just more and more frustration, I think, even at high levels, of among those people that do want this information to come out, that it is time, that people have a right to know. And there's been momentum building in that direction. So I think Tom just sort of stepped in and offered a way to make that happen and just had this ability to pull people together, and having the resources that he had to start a company like this makes a huge difference.
There's a famous quote from Ben Rich, who was the genius at the Skunk Works. He helped develop the U-2, the SR-71, the F-117 Nighthawk stealth fighter, amazing other technologies that maybe we won't see for another 50 years. And he is quoted as saying that we have technology in the black world that will take us to the stars. It would do it right now. We don't have to have E.T. get a ride home. We could take it ourselves. And he said, but it's so wrapped up in and classified programs, it will never see the light of day. You know, he said that a couple of years before he died. And then you have somebody like Steve Justice from that same company, from the Skunk Works, talking about this very exotic technology that, for all intents and purposes, sounds like a flying saucer and then some, that could not only fly through space and bend time, but go through matter. That could have been the headline as well.
I know. I think it's true, although he's talking about something in the future. He's talking about something that he intends through this project to develop and hopefully to build. But I agree with you. I don't know to what extent, what access he has to information from the inside about anything that's already been developed. That I don't know. But I do know that he wants to develop it, and I think he feels, as much as he loved his job at Skunk Works and has nothing but praise for that company, he does feel that there's a certain freedom that he has once he's independent of the corporate world to be more creative and to do things that he couldn't do inside, to bring it out in the open. I think that's the key thing. So I don't know. I don't know how much they might already have. You probably know more about that than I do. But
well, I have some guesses. The other part that seems to have rubbed people the wrong way is Tom, the entertainment division that he's going to launch, that has launched, the idea of producing films and books and documentaries and things of that nature. I don't know why people are mad about that. Tom has talked about that since the very beginning, since before he had these other plans in mind, that he was going to use those platforms to reach an audience beyond what would be reached at a UFO conference or just a normal UFO book. I think it's ambitious and it could work.
I know. I mean, it is something that he's been doing for a while, and it's something he loves to do and something he's good at and something that can generate some revenue. So I don't really get why people are so upset with that either. I mean, it's just one branch of the company now, where before it was the whole company. And it is, why not keep that going? It's been successful, and it's a good way to, he feels it's a really good way to reach people, especially younger audiences. And maybe it will help finance some of the science work that they want to do. If they can make a successful go at various projects that they have in mind, not only does it get the information out to a big audience, but it also allows them to develop, to raise some revenue, which they need in order to finance some of the scientific research that they want to do. So makes sense to me. I don't really have a problem with it. I mean, my only issue as a journalist is to be very clear about what's fiction and what's nonfiction. I'm not crazy about blending fiction and nonfiction, but that's my particular personal taste. But I think as long as they're clear about that, it's great. Why not?
Hey, Leslie, I don't know what kind of reaction you got from your editors or how many people read your stories, but I would think that maybe there'd be a call for you to do more on this topic.
I would be happy to do more, George, and I would like to, and I intend to. So stay tuned, and I'm hoping that, as things develop, I can continue to do the stories and people can learn about what's going on. And let's just keep going. I hope you keep covering it, too. Your coverage, your interviews with Tom have been fantastic and really important. And I hope you can continue the coverage as well.
Oh, count on it. Thanks, Leslie. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, and thanks, of course, George. Take care.
We have links to Leslie Kane's previous work and her articles and her books on the Coast to Coast website. In a moment, we shift gears, but not very much. The Tic Tac UFO incident that was discussed at that Tom DeLonge event October 11th, pretty dramatic stuff. It's not the only one. It's not the only encounter the U.S. military has had with a craft that looks like that. And filmmaker Jeremy Corbell will be here to talk about that and a lot more. So stick around. Switch gears, but just a little bit now, to talk about a very unusual incident. The scene is November 14th, 2004, about 100 miles off the coast of San Diego. The Nimitz Carrier Strike Group, that's led by the USS Nimitz, aircraft carrier, one of the most powerful and sophisticated ships of war in the entire world. It's accompanied by the Ticonderoga-class guided missile cruiser, the USS Princeton. They encounter something really strange, and they dispatch a number of different fighter planes to go check it out. And this thing looks like a gigantic tic-tac that made some incredible maneuvers, zipping up and down from 80,000 feet or so to hover just 50 feet above the water. There was something under the water causing some kind of a disturbance. There were radar sightings. There were visual sightings. There were film recorded of this incident. Investigations commenced, and then the whole thing sort of went away. Chris Mellon spoke about this event during the Tom DeLonge announcement October 11th in Seattle. Other than Chris Mellon's mention, the only incident or no only report about this was in an aviation publication called Fighter Sweep. And some of the principals involved had revealed that this thing had happened. Some information made its way onto the internet, and then it got pulled. The only person to speak about it publicly has been Jeremy Corbell, a filmmaker who has been my guest a number of times on this program, and is back to talk about the Tic Tac UFO and new information and witnesses that he's contacted. And wow, is this a heck of a case. We'll be right back with more. Welcome back. Jeremy Corbell is a filmmaker with a passion for the weird. He set out to tell the tale of the late Dr. Roger Lear, who was our guest on this program many times over the years. That's the guy who surgically removed alien implants from people. And we have quotation marks, air quotes around the word alien. In his film, Patient 17, Jeremy Corbell explores Dr. Lear's legacy and the truth behind alien implants. And we'll get to that in just a bit. But first, we're going to talk about Tic Tacs. Jeremy, welcome back.
Hey, George, great to be on. Thanks for having me. This is a night that was many years in the making.
I want to say, for full disclosure first, because journalism compels me to say this, that I am working with you on a project regarding Skinwalker Ranch. It's a film that I started working on a long time ago and never finished, and you're working on it now, and I'm helping you with your film. But I wanted people to know that going into this before we start our conversation. The Tic Tac UFO. Other than Robert Powell, whose Facebook post of Friday we put online on our Coast to Coast website, other than him, I don't think ufology has written one word about the Tic Tac UFO incident. And yet when it was announced on October 11th, the reaction was, that's kind of old news. We're going to write another book about Roswell because that's new news. Do you, as far as you know, has ufology, anybody there written, done anything with this case?
No, it's actually really difficult. This case is fundamentally difficult because it's a military UFO case and it's current. It's modern day. It's 2004, at least the one that is outwardly put on a blog. So this is a difficult case because it is current, because it's military. I personally have struggled with what information is classified and what is not. That was a huge gift given to the public by Chris Mellon, and people might have missed that point, but we're going to hit that tonight.
Well, let's tell the story. What happened on that day? Your version of it, or maybe you want to start with how you've got your way into this story.
Sure. I mean, look, it was more than 3 years ago today, and I heard whispers of this story. I was tipped off in some way by sources. This is one of the most dramatic modern-day UFO and USO military encounters in modern history. This is an incredible case. I heard about it, but there was no public mention. And so those spider bots, you put out little Google search terms and things ping back. So you get names like Nimitz, Princeton, 2004. And then all of a sudden, an article pops up. And this article, it tells the story from a firsthand experience through a friend of the pilot. And you can read all about it. And so that was really the genesis to start hitting this hard and trying to contact the principals of this story and learn as much as I could silently and under the radar before this got changed or distorted or twisted. So that was kind of my experience, was I was lucky enough to kind of get tipped off on it, and then there was public mention, and it was go time. It was time to start looking into this and finding out exactly what happened and who can I speak with and what can I learn before the public knew about this, just to make sure it didn't get distorted.
So did the principals involved in this, the people who were actually hands-on eyewitnesses, did they know that announcement was coming?
No. Actually, I was able to let them know, the people that I was in communication with, that this story was coming out. And I thought, of course they would know, but oddly enough, the main individual and the individuals involved in this case did not know that this was going to be publicly announced and handed on a silver platter to the public and also, you know, as you mentioned earlier in the show, to Congress as a way, as a push button for this other announcement. So no, people were in the dark.
Can you sort of walk us through it? I know there's the version that appears in the magazine article of the story. There's a version that Chris Mellon told. There's a version that Robert Powell tells on that Facebook post. Can you walk us through the sequence of events as best you know about what happened?
Absolutely. I have to say that most everybody got this wrong except for the first public mention, which was in that article that Chris Mellon referenced when he came on stage. What actually happened that day is something very different than what you're reading other than in that blog report. So, you know, let's start from the very beginning. First of all, something that's not understood, this is not an isolated event. Between November 10th and November 14th of 2004, there was a series of events involving the Nimitz Carrier Strike Group that took place. And that's just off the coast of San Diego. And essentially, there was just phenomenal aerial, you know what, they call them AAVs. This is something I've kept to myself for quite some time, anomalous aerial vehicles. That is an intelligence term used similarly to UAP, which is the new version of UFO, right? But that is the term that is used. So on these days leading up to the 14th, which is the report that we know about in the blog, there were a number of these, you know, contacts. So, you know, the fire control officer and the fire control senior chief, they had detected multiple returns descending far above, like, the radar that they had, the scan volume, which was 80,000 feet or higher. And these targets that were dubbed anomalous aerial vehicles, they would drop down from 80,000 feet and hit and hover at 50 feet above the water in a matter of seconds. So just imagine NORAD, or imagine any of our, you know, really complex radar systems looking at this. This looks like a threat. This looks like ICBMs coming into our atmosphere. So this raised a lot of alarms. A lot of people knew about this, and it was happening for multiple days. And then we get the report, and this is the report that's online. It was written by a man named Paco. And, you know, he himself, you know, he flew A-6E intruders, F-14As, Tomcats. You know, he had 10 years active duty. This is a guy who's also very qualified as a pilot. And he's writing this in an obscure aviation blog. And he's writing about a friend of his. And all of this is public, and you can read it. So I'm not saying anything new in this. But he talks about a primary pilot who had direct engagement with this object.
Direct engagement meaning what?
Meaning, well, you can read about it in the blog, but meaning when he came in, you know, he was out on a normal mission, a normal day, and he's going out from the Nimitz, and he's doing his routine, you know, operations. And he essentially gets a call asking what ordnance that he has on board his plane, which was a strange request because he's right off the coast of California. So he replies back, says what ordnance he has. He's given coordinates, and he's said to go basically investigate. So there he goes, and he rolls up on this object. And this object, you know, first thing is, this is an object. It was specifically uniformly white. It was, that's why they call it the Tic Tac. It was about 46 feet long, which is like roughly fighter jet sized. In fact, these are some details that are not publicly said, but it had a discernible midline, a horizontal axis, like a fuselage, but it had no visible windows, no propulsion systems, no heat exhaust. We're looking at this, or he was looking at this through FLIR. FLIRs are highly advanced, forward-looking infrared radiometer. It's thermal. It's a thermographic camera. I mean, it detects things in 3 to 12 micrometers. It's this incredible technology that we have. So he's looking at this object, and it's sitting there, just hovering. Below this object is a large 747-size dark USO, unidentified submerged object. The water was churning. It was just churning in a circle. And I'm just giddy right now because I came on last time to Coast to Coast. I couldn't say any of this. I mean, I was only essentially putting a fish hook out to see if one in a million chance I could get some other contacts in this case. And sure enough, after the broadcast, I got further contacts in this case. So this is so exciting. So there it is. There's this USO churning water, and this Tic Tac, as they call it, was essentially docking. It was docking with this other object, for lack of a better word, and it took off. It took off blinding speed. Not only do we have a fighter pilot who is, you know, highly credited, is a trained observer, we have footage. And that's something that's super interesting. That's something that was promised, actually, by Chris Mellon and his whole group, was that there would be this clear military footage. But I myself was worried about classification of this footage as I was investigating it.
So you had it, but you couldn't say you had it.
I did.
And now it's out there.
Now, this morning, like a gift from above, it came out online. I confirmed this was, in fact, the direct footage from the pilot, from the fighter pilot. This is real footage of an AAV, anomalous aerial vehicle, like a UAP or UFO, something that uses non-traditional propulsion that is not like anything that we on Earth have.
You know, I'm not a pilot. I don't know how to interpret the images I saw, but I watched the film today, of course, I mean, you obviously have seen it multiple times. What do you make of it?
Yeah, so you have to understand the footage in its context. So as I was saying before, and this is really interesting, there's footage from this FLIR system, but when the pilot went to engage this object, the object actively jammed all the weapons systems. And this is a modern fighter pilot, a modern fighter plane. This thing actively jammed all those systems. But we do have this FLIR footage. So it looks black and white. But you have to understand, you can read altitude, you can read time, you can see velocity in this. This video, when analyzed appropriately by people who know what they're looking at, I mean, this is huge that it got out. I don't know if it's classified. I don't know if it should be classified. That was my dilemma. I couldn't even show it to the primaries in the case that I was talking with because I didn't know if I had something that shouldn't be shown. But it is, in fact, now out, and people can analyze it. And
so you're worried about showing it, sending it to the primary witnesses, and it's something that they should not have, and if they had it and it's still classified, they could get in trouble for it.
Absolutely correct. Now, here's the deal. That's speculation. But, you know, I like to work as a journalist from the point of, okay, this is, you know, what is legal that I can do, and then this is what is illegal. So my problem that I had even last time I was on, that is something I haven't told anybody until today. So, in fact, yes, I had the footage for a long time, and this footage was leaked onto YouTube in the early days of YouTube, and they would share it and pass it around, but people couldn't screen grab these images or these videos as easily as they could today. So the big question was, is this classified? Now, I know there was at least one intelligence report done. I believe it was by the DIA. And essentially, they looked into this in 2007. And, you know, from there, it wasn't clear if this footage was classified or not. But at this point, it's out again, not by my hand. So I can talk about it. You can see it. It will be analyzed.
And so did you run it by your primary witnesses to say, hey, is this what you saw that day?
Absolutely, I did, and 100% confirmed that is the video. That is the same video that came out, was leaked onto YouTube somehow in a mysterious way, originally back in 2004, I believe. So right around that time, or just after that time, this is the video. You are seeing the real deal when you
see it. So tell me a little bit about approaching these witnesses. You know, these guys have security clearances, top secret stuff, and I would imagine they're a little afraid to talk to somebody they don't know about these things.
Yeah, I always kind of reflect on this. You know, you get some guy calling you. You look him up online. He makes UFO films, and, you know, I'm bearded with tattoos. I mean, honestly, I find it hard that people will talk with me. But, you know, over time, you know, they will begin to realize that I'm not somebody who's just going to come in and, like, take their story or break their trust. So I have earned the respect, and I have earned the situation where people will talk to me usually. It doesn't always happen, but also I am genuinely curious about this. And you know what? Anybody who's seen something like the Tic Tac or anybody who's been involved in this experience, you know, they are also genuinely interested. And so that, I think, bonds us over time. But it takes years sometimes to have these types of relationships. It just does. So it's touch and go.
You know, the article that was on that fightersweep.com, there I was, the X-Files edition. These guys are serious dudes. I mean, these pilots, they're the best and the brightest, and there they are encountering something that they don't want to admit is real, and they kind of dance around it in that language in the article, but they're telling us, hey, this is real. I wonder if you get the same sense in talking to the primary witnesses, what they make of this.
Absolutely. I mean, I asked, you know, a question like, so you don't really know what you saw? And I got a quick response. I know what I saw. I'm telling you what I saw. I know what I saw. But there still looms this question. You know what you saw, but what does it mean? What are the implications of what you saw? And that's the hard part. You can describe specifically, as I told you before, what this thing looked like. No wings, no traditional propulsion systems, looked like an oblong, 46-foot-long, porcelain white with a horizontal axis like a fuselage. But what does that mean when you see this thing zip away and outrun anything that we have in known technology? That piques the curiosity of any human being.
And do they answer you? Do they go as far as to say what they think it is?
You know, of course, we talked about speculation with any of the witnesses involved with this case that I spoke with. There is speculation on what it could be. But that comes down to personal understanding, personal belief. It definitely defied all known characteristics of modern propulsion by any means.
I know at one point, I guess a radar operator on one of the ships, maybe it's the Princeton, relays that it is in communication with the planes, and he says this thing just disappears, and then all of a sudden it reappears in a very strange place.
So this object that we're calling the Tic Tac, and again, I want to repeat, this is not an isolated incident. We know that this was going on from the 10th through the 14th. I'll go a little further and say that off the coast of California was not the only incident of the Tic Tac appearing, this sort of thing appearing. But on that day, it was vectored by the Princeton and Banger. Okay, so these are two ships that basically, from what I understand, were able to catch this thing on radar. So this thing was vectored in. They knew about it from the 10th all the way to the 14th when you read about that article.
I'll tell you what, Jeremy, before we continue, we're going to have to take a break. But that's a great That's a great dramatic place to end. We'll continue the conversation about what the Tic Tac did, this amazing maneuver, in a moment, talking with filmmaker Jeremy Corbell. We're talking about an incident from November of 2004. The USS Nimitz battle group, carrier group, off the coast of Southern California. They detect something pretty strange. They send a couple of their best planes toward it. Fast Eagle 01 and Fast Eagle 02 are the call signs for these planes. Four aviators on board. What they saw was unlike anything else they had ever seen before. This 46-foot-long Tic Tac hovering over the water, doing things that nothing should be able to do. And something else was under the water, as if it was trying to dock with the Tic Tac. And they were able to record some video. We're going to be posting an independent link to that video so you can see it on the Coast website here in a minute. And Jeremy Corbell will pick up the story of what happened next. We'll be right back. So, Jeremy, before the break, we're telling the story about these aviators who encounter this gigantic Tic Tac. I want to back up for a second. They make the sweep in. I'm trying to remember the article, but they make the sweep in. And this thing suddenly notices them, and it reacts to them, right?
And reacts to them. It actually turned and angled towards them, almost like looking. And this was, you know, astounding, because you have this large, hovering, tic-tac object. I really want to drive this home. This is a modern-day UFO and USO case. From a military perspective, with film footage, eyewitness testimony, it is a dream case. The only looming thing, the cone of silence, the security, all of this is the problem. This is something that happened. It is now out. It is public. And it is something that people should be after. They should be after this. Not disrupting the lives of the people involved, but everything we can as citizens to understand more about this, because this is modern day. It is now. So this thing notices them. And remember, so this is a tic-tac or tic-tacs, multiple, that were hovering over the same spot. It was a latitude and longitude of about 30 nautical miles, so like 34.5 miles off the coast of Baja, you know, just southeast of Tijuana. This thing is just off the coast of California. These AAVs descended, hovered, and zipped away at impossibly fast speeds. And that's a quote, impossibly fast speeds.
And then it reacts to them by turning sort of in their direction. And then, as I was mentioning, the guy on, I think it's the Princeton or one of the other ships, the radar guy, is sort of interacting with them. And then, at least as far as his sensors are concerned, this thing disappears and then reappears behind the fighter, right?
Okay, well, there's a lot of misunderstanding with this event, and we're still kind of looking at how many people interacted with this. Because remember, the only mention of this publicly is on the 14th of November in 2014. But we do know that these objects were doing this same old game from the 10th to the 14th. And again, this is not an isolated incident. So there are other pilots that did have engagement with these objects. This is not an isolated event. So the way that it moved around them, all I can say is what I know is that when the object noticed one of the pilots, it turned, pointed its nose toward it, and then faster than you can snap your fingers, this thing ascended and disappeared.
Goes to like 80,000 feet or beyond in seconds.
Beyond. Because that's the scope of the radar system. We have the Spy-1, for example, that was out there, which is an incredible piece of technology. But prior to this, we had all sorts of agencies and radar systems looking at these objects and what was going on over days. And I do want to say this is something now that people can look up. It is public information. So I do want to say the fleet commander at that time, he is now in the private sector, was Vice Admiral Durwood C. Curtis. He was the big dog that day. I believe the captain of the Nimitz that day, I believe, was Admiral or Vice Admiral Ted N. Branch. In 2013, he assumed the office as the 65th Director of Naval Intelligence. He had a call sign of Twig. So So this guy, these are major players. So I just want to put that out there. This is public information. So we should be asking questions, because these people have intimate knowledge of.
Well, I'll definitely come back to the investigation, but before we move on to that, so the footage, we're posting an independent link on the Coast website so people can watch it. I've seen it. I don't know what to make of it. I guess you need to have the narrative to go along with it to understand what you're seeing. But there's an object clearly right in the center of this device that's being used to record those images.
Right. The narrative is really important with the video footage. When you're looking at FLIR footage, you have to understand what you're looking at. And absolutely, this footage, I can tell you it is the footage of the Tic Tac on the day described on November 14th in the article written by Paco. That is the footage. So it's black and white. You see an object. You have to look at altitudes, speeds, all of this stuff. But we have actual FLIR footage of this. The background is what gives this footage so much importance. We have direct eyewitness narrative that goes with this military footage.
So what are these guys, what happens after? They fly back to the Nimitz. What happens then? Are they debriefed?
Yeah, so they go and they essentially kind of pass the baton right after the fleet. So right after the pilots that you read about in the article that's online, there were other pilots that went out right after to the same coordinates. So, you know, everything is so compartmentalized. It's got to be frustrating for some of the pilots that engaged the object or attempted to engage it when their weapon systems were actively jammed. So there were a lot of people, actually, that had kind of encounters with this object or these objects. In fact, there was something just I heard, as we say out here where I live, word on the wash, but I heard that the next day on the Nimitz itself, a bunch of the crew went out with tinfoil hats on to salute at sea. So it was something that was passed around among the ranks. This is something a lot of people know about, not just these, you know, the fleet commander and the captain of the Nimitz, who I named, not just them, but a lot of crew knew about it. Now, who had personal, direct experience within 100 feet about of this object? Not many people.
All right. In the fightersweep.com, the original article, that they had said that the principals, at least that are mentioned in this article, were debriefed. That, yes. I guess that's by the Navy, by the people at the Nimitz. I don't know if they were debriefed again by others. Did you ask any of them about who came to talk to them or how often?
Well, there are limited things that someone can tell another person based upon what information is classified or what security clearances they have. I mean, I have none. So there's limited information that can be provided. But I do happen to know, just as a journalist, that there was a 2007 intelligence study that was done on this particular case. And that's fascinating to me. That is something that people can look into. And again, I mean, I just kind of word on the wash. I heard it might be DIA, but there are different intelligence agencies all throughout all branches of government. But this is something that I know was done. So a very clear and concise report of these events was established. So that's a matter of FOIA, although there's not going to be a lot of information that can be garnered from that. And actually, a lot of the information you do get through FOIA, like I believe some of the information that's recently come out was grossly inaccurate, but that's just simply because of the people who are logging these reports might not have had firsthand experience with these objects.
Meaning that somewhere along the way, somebody wrote something in the early stages that got leaked out, and that since then, more information has become available that sort of amplifies or corrects or clarifies some of the initial information.
More that I encourage everybody to read the article that is online that you have mentioned, that Chris Mellon handed to the audience, to the public on a silver platter by giving the exact Google keywords in order to reach that article in a single stroke of the computer keys. I suggest reading that. That is the most accurate. There was another document I read that came out with the video this morning, and it's basically a log. But that log was done by kind of a secondhand experiencer. It was grossly inaccurate to what was going on that day, and that's just the kind of thing you get through FOIA. I mean, that's why I'm hopeful this information can kind of reach out past that cone of silence, because maybe some people like Chris Mellon are interested in getting it out.
Well, I wonder how far that goes, because somewhere along the line, this got stuck in a drawer. You know, there was an investigation. I would think the Navy, at least what I was told, that this is the Navy did one, and it got buried, and then that other agency did one, and that never went public, or at least hasn't so far. I know there was an outside-the-government attempt to get to the bottom of it some time ago, and if they succeeded, it hasn't seen the light of day. So do you have an idea about what became of any of those investigations?
Well, I think that they got the information that they were looking for, and they're not going to tell you or me. But I also think that now that this is a public case, now that all of these facts and details are put out there, and it is a modern-day UFO, USO case, I think we have a chance. We have a puncher's chance, a fighting chance. There are people within the aerospace industry, the Department of Defense, NASA, who have been instrumental, I mean, to me personally, and also to cases like this, for getting information out. And there seems to be a coordinated attempt, you know, within the Department of Defense or the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. You know, these agencies, there are people that want this information out. But the issue is always, how much can we get, how much can we learn, and what does it mean? We're not even talking about that yet.
So let's talk a little bit about the DeLong announcement, because that's sort of where the Tic Tac incident stems from, that announcement that put this on the front burner. These guys step forward and say UFOs are real, and we're going to work with DeLong and try to get this stuff out. And it's been pretty nasty. People have legitimate questions. Of course they do. They want to know how this is going to work, in particular when there's money involved, when you're being asked to invest or something like that. It's perfectly understandable. People want to know how it is. I think, a lot, as we were talking to Leslie in the first hour, it seems like people have jumped to a lot of conclusions, and the story has not been told. Maybe you can fault To the Stars for not getting all that information out right away, or however you want to do it. But I think that there's still a lot of information to come out that will clarify things. But what's your general reaction to what you heard on October 11th?
You know, I was fascinated by the presentation. I think people are missing the high notes of what happened on that day. And for whatever reason, you know, it might be the stardom of Tom DeLong, or people just don't, you know, want to kind of associate him with this. It doesn't matter. If you just take that part of the equation out and look about what happened, I want to give him credit for bringing those people together, but just look what happened on that stage. We've talked a little bit about Chris Mellon handing the public the Tic Tac case on a silver platter. Let's talk about Lou Elizondo. This guy is a former high-ranking Department of Defense official who ran a program at the Department of Defense involving the study of anomalous aerial threats. This is a fascinating person. We now know the Pentagon has an active program. I was told years ago by the highest-ranking military individual that I have ever met that every single branch of our military has active investigations into UFOs today, right now. And we have proof, Department of Defense, through Lou, that this has been going on. He confirmed that official unidentified aerial threats program, that exists. It's a UFO program at the Pentagon. And he personally confirmed his understanding that UFOs are real, they exist, and that they have been officially documented. I mean, he said this. He said this in his quotes with Leslie Keene: "I learned that the phenomenon is indeed real. The fact is, we might not necessarily be alone. This is big. This happened on the stage that day. So people need to get out of their own way and look at what happened on that day. And there's more that happened on that day. Lou also said, we are planning to provide never-before-released footage from the U.S. government systems, not blurry amateur photos, but real data and real videos. That's a direct quote. I wonder if he was thinking to release the footage of the Tic Tac.
I thought his use of one particular word was pretty interesting. He used the word liaison, that he intends to be a liaison between this To the Stars thing and active government entities, meaning, you know, it sounds like a partnership on this stuff. Maybe it'll take a while to dribble things out. It's not going to happen overnight, but that reading between the lines, that use of that word seemed pretty important.
Yeah, I mean, he can't declassify things himself, but acting as a liaison, you know, for the organization, you know, that makes me very hopeful. I also want to touch upon what Jim Semivan said. I mean, this is a guy, you know, in the CIA since 1983. He had 25 years solid in the CIA. He said one of the most extraordinary things in the articles. He said, I have come to realize that the phenomenon is curiously multifaceted, exasperatingly complex, and appears to exist both in our consensus reality and in other unknown space. Perhaps, if we're lucky, someday we may understand its ultimate purpose. I mean, holy cow, this is said by a CIA official. This is pretty cool. I think people just were maybe expecting something different, or they got thrown off by the fact that this must be a business of some sorts, that they're missing the point of what was said at that press conference. To me, it was very exciting. I thought it was cool.
Well, I like the stuff from the Skunk Works guy, too. I'm the former Advanced Project Skunk Works guy who's talking about building this amazing craft. And it, again, reading between the lines, he says the technology is doable.
Yeah.
The implication being we already have one, or we know it can be done somehow.
Yeah, that was Steve Justice, and that really threw me for a loop, because it is my understanding from all the evidence that I have gained over the years, we have not cracked anti-gravitics. We just haven't. The idea that a private company is needed to do this blows me away. You know, it's my understanding from the Lazar case that it requires super heavy elements that we don't have in abundance unless we're gifted them. So the fact that Steve Justice said that that's what he's looking to do, and he's, you know, former advanced systems director for Lockheed Martin Skunk Works. I mean, this is a guy that knows what he's talking about. So that really was fascinating. And in fact, I talked with a scientist who I very much respect, who is on the inside, and I asked him, do you think we can do this with the technology that we have, you know, gained or learned from these AAVs? And he said yes. And that blew me away. I'm still grappling with that, because I was strongly in the position that we didn't really have a shot at this quite yet.
So we're talking with filmmaker Jeremy Corbell about the Tic Tac case, about the DeLong announcement. And Jeremy just mentioned about Bob Lazar. We might hear from him a little bit later. Also still ahead, Patient 17, the film that Jeremy's been working on. And we did get a call, Jeremy, during the program, during your discussion, from somebody who was on the USS Nimitz. We're going to hear from them soon. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with filmmaker Jeremy Corbell. The first hour with Jeremy, we talked about the Tic Tac UFO. We will return to that subject in our last hour when we go to the phones, because as I mentioned before the break, we got a call from someone who said they were on the Nimitz at the time of the incident. We'll see if they saw anything, heard anything a little bit later. In between now and then, we're going to shift gears a bit. I told you Jeremy's a filmmaker. Extraordinary Beliefs is sort of the umbrella title that he has for his film projects, a lot of the topics that we cover here. In a moment, we're going to pick up the conversation about Patient 17. The last time Jeremy was here, we talked about him making it and what he had found, the strange material inside Patient 17, as it was Object 17 that's undergone a lot of rigorous scientific testing. We'll find out where things stand and what's happening with the film right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Jeremy Corbell, let's talk about Patient 17. For those who didn't hear the last time when you were on to talk about working on that project, let's start with Dr. Roger Lear, how you hooked up with him.
Sure. So Dr. Lear was investigating the alleged implant phenomenon. He was surgically removing foreign bodies from select patients and analyzing them elementally and isotopically. At the time when I was first approached by Dr. Lear about this, I didn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. My good friend Ruben Langdon essentially said, come on, talk to Dr. Lear. You know, he's done this for a long time. And Dr. Lear said the same thing. I've been doing this over 2 decades, Jeremy. You got to look into this. So reluctantly, I did. And I filmed what ended up being his 17th and final alleged alien implant removal surgery. And that became the subject of my new film.
Now, what was your agreement with him? Did he put any restrictions on what you could do?
No, in fact, he was adamant that I come and film, and he really wanted me to capture this on camera in the style that I do. The one thing I told him was that if you, Dr. Lear, if you are pulling the wool over people's eyes, or you are fudging the data, or you are manipulating people in any way, I am going to out you. Are you sure you want me to do this, to follow your investigation? And he said, yes. So I said, okay. And
do you happen to know, had you looked at any analysis, whether it had been done on any of the previous objects that had been taken out of people?
You know, I had heard about him, and I had, you know, seen little bits here and there, but no, it was outside of the scope of my knowledge base, interest, or even, you know, believability. I really went into this just thinking, cool, I get to witness a surgery and film it. But that all kind of changed after I met patient 17.
All right, describe the setting, the date, when and where, and what happened.
Well, this was in 2014, and it was a surgical center outside of Los Angeles, or within Los Angeles, and essentially going in there, it was very calm and just like a routine little, you know, cut out a little piece of something out of somebody's leg. But what transpired over those hours we were there, that's where it got extraordinary. You know, you can't underestimate the interest people have in this subject. I mean, the waiting room got flooded with, you know, believers and people that wanted to see and people with interest. And I found myself almost protecting, in a way, patient 17 from the public because he didn't want to be known. He didn't want to be seen. In fact, there's a scene in my film where I literally helped sneak him out the back door because I felt bad for him. And he's just a normal guy, an ordinary guy of extraordinary height. He's 6'9", a megalith of a man. But he was soft-spoken, you know, kind of like the cowboys of past. You know, he was just a soft-spoken, understated individual, totally different than what I thought. And that's what sold me to continue telling this story, was the human element. I wanted to get answers for this man. I wanted to get answers badly.
How did he get talked into doing this? Sounds like he'd have to be dragged kicking and screaming to something like this.
Yeah, he loves just riding his motorcycles. You know, he has a great family, a great life. He's not a fanatic into the UFO thing. He doesn't like public attention. But, you know, his curiosity was there. He had something in his leg that was a foreign object. It had been there for 10 years. We know that by the x-rays. He was kind of convinced by these authorities that maybe it had something to do with his abductive experiences. Now, he knows his abductive experiences are real. He is sure about that. But he remains, like me, the biggest skeptic that the object found in his leg has anything to do with his abductive experiences. And that's what was so interesting to me.
So you've got to know him in between now and 2014 when this started. Have you been around him in a time period when he's had one of these experiences?
I have not been around him when he's had one of these experiences. They began in childhood, and they continued throughout his life. It's not like it's every night. You know, we have to look at this from a bigger picture. Millions of people claim abductive experiences. We need to deal with that on a very factual level. That is fact. Millions of people claim abductive experiences. If you remember, we all remember, John Mack, former head of psychiatry at Harvard University, he even went on Oprah Winfrey with an abductee, a claimed abductee, and talked about this. He believed these were not fictitious, they were not a mental disorder, that these were factual events, that people were having these experiences with non-humans. So I went back and read all of that, got kind of learned about that, and then I followed Dr. Lear, and I tried to follow as he pointed me in what direction to go to in looking at this case.
Oh, so the day of the surgery, do they put patient 17, does he put him out? And what is the chain of custody for the evidence, for the piece of stuff?
Yeah. So they didn't put him out. It was actually a pretty simple procedure. It was just a, as I like to say, small incision, big mystery. You can see it all in my film. They actually go, they put a little antiseptic in there, and they numb it, and they cut. I mean, it is kind of brutal. I mean, they go in there, and they open the flesh with these prongs and, you know, cut out this object, this alloy, this piece of metal, and they pull it out, and they put it in a serum of his own blood, and then that was in the custodianship of Dr. Lear, and then we went to Seal Laboratories to have our first look through the scanning electron microscope to get basic spectral analysis, but just eyes on, visual observation. Is this metal? What do we have?
And?
And it turns out that on that day where I thought we would get all answers, and so did patient 17, that all we got was, it was like people, like my good friend John Lear, looking at a picture of the moon. Everybody saw something different. Essentially, everything looks cool under high magnification. The real tests were yet to be done, and I pushed him on it. I wanted to know what we'd find out today. Even patient 17 said the foundations of his faith as a Christian would be shook if it turns out this object is something out of this world. So on that day, as you'll see in the movie, you know, we come to some conclusions that it's worth further testing, but we don't get the answers. And then sadly, as we all know, Dr. Lear died. And then it was, everybody dropped the ball. Nobody was doing analysis. And it infuriated me. It infuriated patient 17. You can see him get visibly angry in the film. I mean, it's intense. You know, when he goes through this, even when Dr. Lear is alive, he's arguing with Dr. Lear about what this is. So we picked the ball up where people put it down, and I had a lab, Northern Analytic, a great accredited lab, do broad spectrum elemental analysis and isotopic analysis on both zinc and copper.
Well, I remember you telling me about this, and the last time we talked, it certainly seemed like this was odd.
Absolutely odd. Any way you slice this, it is odd. There's 36 different elements within this object, some of which are highly toxic, rare earth elements. It is the majority iron, but at the same time, I had a nanotoxicologist look at this and said, yeah, you're lucky you got this out of somebody's body. But the real interesting point, the point that has pushed me to try to get this sample back for further testing, actually with Jacques Vallée, you know, that is somebody who's looking into this precisely right now in his life. So it was the isotopic analysis that really pushed it over the edge. The results came back on the isotopic analysis of this object that was in patient 17, and the zinc 64 was way above what we'd call the terrestrial norm. So the actual zinc 64, that isotope of zinc, was definitively non-terrestrial, even with a relative standard deviation of 1.25. This thing was outside the terrestrial norm. So it begs further testing. We need to replicate this. I need to get my hands on sample 17 in order to replicate, if we can, these results or to debunk it.
Well, we'll talk about how to get your hands on it in a moment, but back to the test results. So outside the terrestrial norm, sounds like it's leading toward extraterrestrial, but not necessarily?
Well, actually, these results do show that the zinc 64 is not matching with terrestrial zinc 64. You can tell distance by the isotopes within different elements. So the elements on the moon will have different isotopes, let's say, than the elements on Earth. And this zinc 64, it came so far outside the terrestrial norm, the percentage of zinc 64, that you can let your imagination roll there. I mean, this is outside of our galaxy, if it's correct. So the question then becomes, what could cause these results if not non-terrestriality? And I found a zinc 64, extraterrestrial zinc 64 specialist. And this,
who knew?
I mean, this is a weird thing to find, but I found the dude.
And he must have loved it.
He was so set back because now he's just a doctor in middle America, and he wrote some thesis paper back maybe 12 years ago on zinc 64 extraterrestrial isotopes. He thought I was bonkers, and he might be right, but I called him up, and he really thought I was mad. He goes, I know what you're looking at here. Let me see the results. And I said, okay, well, here are the results. And his answer was, you know, you're being duped somehow. The laboratory is messing with you. I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, I'm going to call the laboratory right now. What could cause this? And he says, well, sometimes copper 64, let's say, can interfere with zinc 64 if they don't triple wash and cleanse in this process. So I called the lab. They stand behind the results 100%. And they said, it's your problem what the results are. Our problem is just analyzing it.
So does the lab, they're not offering any kind of opinion. They're not saying, boy, this is weird. They're hands off. Look, here's the results. You do with it what you will.
Absolutely zero opinion. They wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. I mean, they did see, I mean, I heard in the voice of the gentleman I spoke with who's head of the laboratory, you know, he did recognize that what we had was anomalous, but he stands behind the work. They did triple wash it. So it didn't contaminate. I think it's actually with nickel 64, whatever it was. It didn't contaminate. But, you know, the bottom line is, and this was the conversation I had with Jacques Vallée, when he came up to my ranch, we compared notes and data because he's looking into 15 samples right now with broad spectrum elemental analysis and isotopic analysis. So it's right in that wheelhouse. And I showed him it, and he agreed. This deserves more testing because this is truly anomalous at this point. That's where we're going. That's what the movie is about. The movie is about these people going through these experiences and how they're perceiving and interpreting the data.
There's a subtext to the movie as well about the sample, the drama over what happens to the sample. You'd like to do more tests.
Man, I couldn't make this up. I mean, it was crazy. The fighting when Dr. Lear passed away over the custodianship of the sample and then the enigmatically and, you know, interesting character of Steve Colburn, his interesting past, interesting guy. I mean, it was really difficult. I sat there, hands empty, waiting for a FedEx with five scientists in New Mexico who had the most state-of-the-art cutting-edge equipment to look at this and who were willing to look at this for free for me, and I stood there empty-handed. It was a miracle I got this object to Northern Analytic. So the interesting part is getting it back and what we can do from here. I do have good news, but that's where we're set up in the movie right now. If you watch this, you have the whole background for what's about to happen.
Talk to me about patient 17. Has he sort of come out? Do we know his name? Is he trying to keep a low profile? And when you maybe start with the story of when you shared with him these results.
Well, you can see in the film when, you know, Steve Colburn is reading the results. I mean, patient 17 is rolling his eyes. He's just almost furious. You know, we wanted to prove this was a Tonka truck. We wanted to prove this was some sort of, you know, something he picked up in road rash as a child. And it was frustrating to him that it wasn't that easily just, you know, pushed away. That all of this, he's in a pickle. If it's not true, right, then he's crazy. If it is true, that the reality might be even worse. And so that's where he's feeling. He doesn't want public attention. He is a good friend of mine now. We are fighting together to get more information. But no, you're not going to see him running around UFO conferences telling everybody about this. I mean, it was difficult that his face was put on the poster for the movie that's on iTunes. I mean, it's like, that's a big deal. So he's
had a little time to digest it, though. Has it changed his life in any way? I mean, is he still having the intrusions, the experiences?
Yeah, I don't think that the removal of the object has changed anything primarily in his life. This is a guy that likes to play music. I admire him greatly, actually, because, you know, a lot of people talk about stuff, and he does it. He loves to ride his motorcycles. He's the kind of guy you'd want to have around a campfire and just talk stories with. His life is normal. Again, he's got a great wife, a great life. He doesn't want the limelight on this, but his curiosity has been weaponized. He wants to find out.
He doesn't remember being hit by a meteorite as a kid or something, does he?
In fact, I excluded this from the probability of what could have happened. I went to the head meteorite specialist at UCLA, and I had him look at the results. This is, in fact, not as he was being told. Patient 17 was being told there's meteoric iron in this. In fact, there's no meteoric iron. This is not a meteorite. It's not something that just fell into his leg. It is highly advanced. It's technical. It was made by an intelligence, is the best of my information at this time.
Yeah, meaning like it shows signs that it was machined in some way or manufactured.
Manufactured 100%. And and look, all of this is open source. I would love a prosaic explanation for this. To me, it doesn't matter. I would like to know the truth, and so does patient 17. It's all open source on my website. Take a look. Write me personally what your opinion is. However, we're going to get more tests.
Well, that's good. If you're going to get access to the sample again, that's good. So talk about the film, where it is. It's finished now. I saw some notices about your events. You've been having screenings. So where do people see it?
Well, on iTunes is the best way, although it's on all pay-per-view platforms such as like Amazon, Xbox, Vudu, everything you can imagine. I like iTunes. Turn it on, watch the movie. You can click, start, rate it, write a comment. This whole process is to move the needle forward. I want people to watch it because it might actually make a difference in people's lives. The more eyes we have on this film, the more opinions we have and the more intelligence we have where we can move forward with investigation.
Seems like you're making a career out of premieres. You're bouncing from one premiere to the next.
Right.
I'm joking.
Running around, I was at National Museum of Copenhagen. I was able to premiere the film in Europe with my mom. We traveled all around Europe. I got to meet up with amazing UFO people who would see that I was in their city and really host me and my mom and take us around. So that was so cool. And then here in Los Angeles, same thing. Sadly, George, you don't make money off of premieres. You're basically showing the movie for free when people should be buying it. But that's cool. Just showing these things is really fun.
Are you in L.A. or are you in Pioneertown?
I live in Pioneertown, California, but I do like to show my movies in Los Angeles and in the desert out here, like in Palm Springs. Ace Hotel just did that one.
All right, we're talking with Jeremy Corbell about his film, Patient 17. He's got a series of projects that he's working on called, under the umbrella of his title, Extraordinary Beliefs, some other film projects in the works. We might even hear from some of the folks who are behind Jeremy and trying to propagate his films, get them in front of a lot of eyes. Surprisingly or not surprisingly, there's a great deal of interest in UFO-themed film projects and documentaries at present, and we're going to hear more about that in our next segment coming up. We're talking with Jeremy Corbell about his latest film, Patient 17. He's got a lot of other projects in the works, and there is a continuous growing appetite for that sort of material these days. We're going to learn more about that in a moment. And a little bit later, catch an update about Bob Lazar. Stick around. More Coast to Coast AM right around the corner. Jeremy, talking about Patient 17, one of our listeners reminded me of something we talked about the last time you were here, an unusual element that was found in the piece that was taken out of this guy's body. I don't even know how to pronounce this element, but tell me about what it is and what the significance of it is.
Yeah, yttrium. It's pronounced a couple different ways, I guess, but yttrium. There's 410 parts per million within this, which seems small, but that was focused on by a couple people because it's used in making superconductors. It's highly toxic, as you'll see. Somebody in my film talks about how you have to wear a mask when you're machining it because it's deadly. So. This object seems to be fabricated by an intelligence is kind of what everybody's saying, but let's get more tests. Let's get more results. But that was.
Could that be human, though? Could that be us?
Yeah, absolutely. There is always the idea that it could be human. It could be us. But one of the people I went and talked with was a nanophysicist who works with these, minute scale making of combining elements. He described this as a witch's brew of 36 elements found in this object. Again, that's his opinion, and we need more opinions, but it's all open source. Go to my website.
Okay. Well, we'll send people there. I should point out, you know, you've been working on a variety of different projects in this sort of genre for a while, kind of like the starving artist. And it seems like Patient 17 is your first big break. How did that happen, and what is the reaction so far?
Yeah, absolutely it was. I mean, I do this because I love to do this. This is not how I make my living. This is something that I do because I just am so passionate about it. And this was my first break. And I essentially said no to everybody. I mean, tons of companies wanted to buy this film, and nobody would give me final cut. I became known as the guy that says no. It almost became a joke. Like, I'm hard to work with. The thing is, I didn't work with anybody. And one guy called me, and I got in touch with one guy, and he asked me the most important question. He said, "Why do you say no to everybody?" And I said, "I've never been asked that. It's really simple. You can't change a frame of my film." And he says, "We don't want to. And we're The Orchard."
So The Orchard, you know, I watch Netflix here and there when I have some spare time. It seems like about half of the movies that I see, you see that logo for The Orchard pop up. I guess they're pretty big in this field.
Yeah, apparently they're huge, and that's something that I didn't know. But not only are they big, but the person that I'm dealing with is incredibly smart. He has his finger on the pulse, and all the content I watch seems to come out of their company. So they're on to something. They have their finger on the pulse. The Orchard is a company I'm proud and happy to be working with, but in particular with a guy named Jim Martin. He's the guy that really convinced me to get this out and gave me the leeway as an artist.
Well, we've got him. We've got him, and I've got him on the phone primarily because I love the title, the job title he has, Director of Paranormal Content. Jim Martin, can I steal that title?
For sure, George. I think you own that title much more than anyone else.
So is there, I don't know if you can gauge how the reaction is to Patient 17 yet, but help me understand where it fits in the Orchard's plans. Is this a hot time for this kind of stuff?
It is a hot time, and Patient 17 is a big priority for everyone at our company, and we're very honored to have Jeremy on board. And 217, as you know, has been a breakout year for UFO content, UFO documentaries, and it's definitely a renaissance period right now for the genre.
So how do you handle, we have a lot of filmmakers who listen to this program, budding filmmakers, people who want to put their own documentaries together. How do you handle unsolicited material? What happens?
Well, we review everything that comes in and have an open mind when reviewing any titles, but me personally, I really try and focus on the market leaders and who happen to be my heroes as well. So we only have so much time and energy, so we are very selective about what we distribute, obviously, as Jeremy's film shows. And, we try and work on films that we know are going to make an impact and reach a big audience.
And it has to be credible, I guess.
It has to be credible, of course.
Is there anything that's outside of the paranormal that's just too far out for you guys?
You know, it's hard to say. We focus mostly, as of now, on UFO material. That seems to have a really strong demand. I'm a big UFO fanatic myself, so that's what I gravitate towards. I mean, we like ghost material and all of that, but I think with UFOs it's so interesting because there's a lot of evidence, a lot of visual evidence that you can incorporate into films, and that's rare for the paranormal genre.
UFOs have been around a long time. Some of the biggest movies in Hollywood history have had UFOs and aliens. Is there a saturation point, or is there a hunger that's still not satisfied for this stuff?
That's a really great point. I think there's actually a scarcity of content in the home video market, specifically the documentary market, and it's an exciting time now because you have filmmakers like Jeremy. There's a lot of really great movies coming out in this space that really haven't been available in the past. So I think we're just seeing the beginning of this genre, actually, not in terms of a blockbuster Hollywood perspective, but more in terms of putting out the truth, real evidence, real films, real stories. I think it's just the tip of the iceberg.
I see what's happening with Netflix and Amazon and the online content, and I don't understand the business model. I really don't, because it seems like, as I mentioned, leading into our conversation here, I see The Orchard's logo all over the place, all kinds of little independent films and larger projects. And I, I don't know how it works.
Well, the distribution environment has certainly changed. There's a bigger audience than ever now. I mean, as you mentioned, Netflix alone has over 109 million subscribers. And in the past, to reach that many people, you would have to have a Hollywood studio behind you and a full-on worldwide theatrical release. Now we can put films out on Netflix and reach just as many people, I would argue, in a even more efficient way. And the way the business works, it has changed certainly a lot, is we're still selling movies, selling them digitally through platforms like iTunes, Amazon, Google, and then you have streaming services like Netflix that tend to, you know, feature the films after their first run of for sale distribution, and that's given these movies a much longer lifespan, and as I said before, we're just reaching more people than ever before, so it's a very exciting time.
All right, Jim Martin, thanks for chiming in with us here. We'll have you back sometime, and I am getting business cards made up with that title, Director of Paranormal Content for The Orchard. Thanks.
Thank you so much, George. I really appreciate it.
All right. Hey, Jeremy, what else have you got working? What other projects are in the can?
Well, as you know with me, I always have a lot going on, some of which I can talk about, some of which I can't. But at this time, I'm very focused on my next movie that's coming. Although, there will be a Chapter 2 to what's going on with the story of Patient 17.
I know that we have, I hinted about Bob Lazar earlier in the program. I should say that you have been in contact with Bob. He's a controversial figure, always will be in this field. I think so. He's sort of been going through for the last 25-plus years the kind of things that Tom DeLonge is getting hit with now. But you've recently had some conversations with him. How much can you say about that project?
Well, you know, honestly, I want to talk about that. I think that it's important. This is probably, arguably, one of the most important UFO stories, if not the most important, in modern history. It certainly has touched more people than any other UFO story. You have a guy coming out through you back in 1989 basically saying definitively, I worked on reverse engineering the attempt of extraterrestrial vehicles to replicate them. And this has just gone through society. If you stand up anywhere in the world and you say the name Bob Lazar, out of 100 people, a handful is going to know him. So this has been my childhood dream, is to get more and to learn more and to verify the story for myself. This is something that I was told by you a long time ago. You got to talk to Bob. Well, who gets to know Bob Lazar? That's the problem. People don't know him, so it's easy to dismiss him. So my goal, my dream, has always been to get to know and let people get to know Bob Lazar as a person, to get into the details of his story that are personal, that haven't been able to be uncovered because of Bob, because of his unwillingness to open up to the public.
So we have two clips from an interview you've recorded in the last couple of months. Bob's kept a pretty low profile for a while, but I think it will be interesting for folks to hear this because it kind of puts a human face on the name that people know, but the person that they don't know. Let's play the first clip from this.
The biggest roadblock to understanding is the ability to dismiss someone because you don't see them as human, as a person. So what pisses you off?
I mean, disinformation and lies and attacks that have no basis in reality. I mean, you can disagree with me and say, hey, I don't believe that. That's fine. I haven't presented you with enough information. I understand that. I'd probably be in your position. But don't fabricate stuff. There's some important information that needs to be released, and everybody needs to understand the truth to it, and not distorted versions of it. You really need to pay attention to what I'm saying, because I have better things to do than come up with this. I'm not interested in doing this. I don't like being in the public eye. I don't got money for doing this. And quite frankly, I could make up a better lie, but I have no motivation to lie. This hasn't helped me out. It's sent something that it's information that I'm releasing, and that's it.
Not an ordinary life.
That's one thing I would like. I don't like living in a James Bond movie. I like watching James Bond movies.
And yet, Jeremy, You talked him into going on camera.
I did. You know, I think it's when you get to a point where people are twisting your story, you can hear how passionate he is in just that little excerpt right there. When people twist you enough, when you get pushed, and you're someone like Bob who doesn't put up with that, you know, at some point you're going to stand up and you're going to throw a punch back. And that's what I think we're seeing right now with Bob. And I'd like to say, it's happening. This is happening.
It's, I've known him for a long time. He does get testy every now and then when it's sort of the weight of this thing, because he's been Bob the UFO guy for a long time now. We have one other clip. We have an interesting exchange with him. Let's hear that now.
People have been trying to minimize who you are. People have been trying to trivialize who you are. People have been trying to twist your story based on absolutely absurd things. That's got to wear on people to a point. You got to set certain things straight.
It's time to pull things out by the roots, just to get things reset and get people familiar with the story and who I am, and this is what's true. The divergence has increased just over time. I'm trying to tell you exactly the way things were and what I was exposed to. You think there's something more secret than that, that the flying saucers are a cover-up for? Some of this stuff just sounds crazy to me, and I understand I'm biased because I'm behind my eyes and see everything, but this is crazy shit.
That's a pretty funny thing. Is there something more secret than flying saucers? Because that's the story you hear from Bob Lazar. Oh, yeah, that Area 51 stuff, that was... They just made that stuff up to cover up something else that was going on out at Groom Lake, and, you know, it was a cover story, and as if somebody would be fired if that was the plan, because whatever is flying around out there as a result of Bob's story, tens of thousands of people have gone out there in the desert. There's always someone out there watching with binoculars and other kinds of equipment. Every news organization in the world has beaten a path to their door. Congressional investigators have been out there. That operation, that facility, which is critical to national security, has got so much more attention because of Lazar. So if that was somebody's plan to distract attention from there, it didn't work very well. Would you agree?
Yeah, that's what's so absurd. I mean, I love hearing how fired up Bob is in those pieces because, you know, pushing his buttons, you know, he says it like it is. I mean, that is so absurd. What could be – this is a cover story for what? I mean, he's trying to tell you what he experienced, and he's been trying to say this for almost 30 years now, you know, for self-preservation at first, but now it's become something else. It's become personal, and that's what I'm going to explore in the film.
So there is a film in the works.
There is a film in the works, the definitive documentary on Bob Lazar, authorized.
Sort of the personal side of it as much as anything.
Absolutely, like all of my films, in order to know, this is something that one of Bob's dear friends said to me. He says, if you want to know the truth, if extraterrestrials, UFOs, if all of that is true, then you need to understand who Bob Lazar is. Because if you know who Bob Lazar is, you'll know if he's telling you the truth or not.
You know, I know people say he's not a scientist, it's all baloney, his physics don't make sense. I just know that he knows a heck of a lot of stuff about anything electronic, technical, chemical. I'm installing a solar system in my home, and of course, Bob knows all about it. He knows about different variations, different technologies, what works the best. He's inspired to get his own. I mean, you see the evidence if you spend some time with him at his company, that he works on a lot of different stuff at the same time.
Well, in fact, for 7 days and seven nights, I stayed at his house, and I was able to see his everyday life from coffee in the morning till bedtime, and I was able to see the way he interacted with clients and agencies that would call him for different kinds of information, and it was incredible. I almost played that clip for you tonight where he talks just about that. How that's crazy. He doesn't sound like a scientist. And he explains that to you in this clip that I didn't play tonight. So yeah, the more you get to know Bob, the more you realize the stories out there trying to debunk him, the ridiculous stories that have zero evidence. And then that's the thing. The stories people say about him have less evidence than Bob has about UFOs. It's absurd. So it's so cool to hear him, you know, talk and to really get to know who he is as a person, because that's the key here. That's really going to be it for people, is they judging him based upon such a limited amount of data. Well, you're about to have a lot more data.
You mentioned about agencies, and it makes it sound like he's been working with the CIA or something. There are government entities that come to him for problems at times, right?
Well, absolutely. When Element 115 was fabricated here on Earth, he was contacted by those scientists for whatever data he had or information or input. As absurd as that sounds, that is indeed the case. So people do contact Bob from clients, you know, that just want to know a little bit more about the elements that they're working with. I mean, I heard him on the phone. He literally says, who do you want me to call? Who do you want to have access to? You can have access to everybody and anybody. Let's do this right.
We're talking with filmmaker Jeremy Corbell. Patient 17 was one of the projects. He's working on a film about Bob Lazar. There's some other things he's got in the works as well. When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines, including a call from that serviceman who was on the USS Nimitz during the time of the Tic Tac UFO. Stick around. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Jeremy Corbell, filmmaker, about Patient 17 and other projects of his. We're going to open up the phone lines in a moment here and talk to you about whatever's on your mind. Hope you have some questions for Jeremy about his projects. He has a pretty good depth and breadth of experience now. I'm willing to let you tee off on me about Tom DeLonge if you're mad about that, or whatever's on your mind. We'll be right back with your calls, questions, and comments here on Coast to Coast AM. So, Jeremy, before we go to the phones, you mentioned about the trip to Denmark. I was fortunate enough to go a couple of years ago to speak to that group. It's just a great group, and Denmark's such a cool country. Copenhagen's such a great city. How was your film received? Is there a language or cultural issues in how it's interpreted?
Yeah, the only parts when I watch this film go that really get me twisted up, I want to see if people laugh at the right points. There is a dry humor in my film because I'm looking at this just like anybody would, any viewer, and I'm going through these experiences, and there are some big twists and turns, some serious twists and turns in this film that I'm going through as a filmmaker. So I just want to see if people laugh. And it's incredible. In Denmark, my host, Frederick, he is so cool. And the audience, everybody speaks English there. I mean, mainly people really do have a great grasp of English. So they really did receive the film well. That was such a fun trip. And to see it on a big screen in such a prestigious theater, the National Museum, And that's free, by the way. That's available now. People can watch that presentation and lecture free. So it was such a cool experience. The UFO community is the coolest community. They took me and my mom out for beers all over Europe. It was like the drunk history of Europe with my mom.
I saw some photographic postcards from there. It looked like you were having way too much fun. I want to mention you had also, so people can see that on your website, that presentation, and also you posted something about Lazar.
Oh yeah, this is great. So after a few years, finally, I made a short film on Bob Lazar where it showed the history that you had reported on, and then essentially brought in a few minutes of extra testimony because it was just, I wanted people to see Bob now saying what he had to say now. All of that is free. I've just unlocked that. That's free also on my website. People can just watch that snip of Bob Lazar talking current, modern day. Of course, there's a lot more coming, but I think that was a big give, a 20-minute free piece for everybody to watch there. And the National Museum one is 50 minutes long. Really cool content. And there's also, for the first time in his history, Eugene Roddenberry, my friend Rod, we call him Rod. He is the son of Gene Roddenberry, creator of Star Trek. And he went on camera with me and publicly talked about his views on aliens, extraterrestrial life, and UFOs. And that you can also find there. It's the first time he ever did that, which I thought was crazy.
Yeah, we used a piece of him last week when we had the Star Trek technology guy, on the program, talking about his dad interacting with the scientists of the day to sort of preview the future. It's cool.
Oh, yes.
Hey, Jeremy, one more question before we, there's a lot of phone calls holding on here, but I wanted to ask you about Pioneer Town, because it's a, if people don't know it, it's a, out in the desert. It's a weird little cool vibe. People go there and live off the grid kind of. It was created as a movie set, and I swear it could be a movie set now. It's as if all the characters are kind of from central casting for like an interdimensional sitcom. But you, it's, it would seem like if you're going to see a UFO, it'd be in Pioneer Town, and you have.
Yeah, in fact, I have. You know, I've been pointing my camera at other people, you know, for almost, I guess it would be almost maybe, well, at least the audio recorder for 13 years now, and I had never seen anything myself that was extraordinary, something that was a true unidentified flying or floating object until I moved to Pioneer Town. And you're right, this place is still active with filming, especially because I'm here. The stories out here are exceptional, just exceptional. This place, people gravitate here from the fields of music and art, and you do not underestimate the people out here. But I did see something that I cannot explain. And the only reason you know about that is because of a little tiny podcast. This guy named Ken Lane does something called The Desert Oracle, The Voice of the Desert. Man, it's like you are in this world of the Mojave when you listen to it. So he gave me a few beers, got me talking, and sure enough, episode one on his podcast is me telling my first unexplained experience with this phenomenon. And it was wild. It was intense, and my buddy was with me, who's one of the biggest skeptics, and he always was joking with me about what I do for a living. Sure enough, we brick our phones, and this object comes down the mesa on my ranch and floats above these Joshua trees, splashing this amber light, totally silent. It was like 6 to 8 feet in diameter. I got my telescope and measured it because I'm a maniac. And it was astounding. He thought we were being watched by some sort of military or something. I mean, he really got scared when this thing happened. And I was really calm, which was very strange. You'd figure I'd be jumping up and down, but grabbing my camera. But it was a beautiful thing. It was this strange, luminous, large, silent, glowing object. And I have no explanation. I mean, I thought I'd see a disc. I want to see a mothership, a craft. I've never seen anything like that. But
well,
it
kills me. It kills me.
I know.
Let's take some calls. West of the Rockies, Ryan in Seattle. Hey, Ryan, how you doing?
Hey, good evening, gentlemen. I have a question for Jeremy, but first let me set up my question by saying that the question has to do with Dr. Roger Lear, rest in peace. Before he passed away, and I know you spent some time talking to him, and George, you did too. Before he passed away, he was going out and doing lectures and going to different radio shows, including appearing on George Knapp's show for 2 hours. He really wanted to tell people about a personal experience that he had. And you guys are probably familiar with this, but he was attending a UFO conference in Turkey. And during that time, the entire country of Turkey was experiencing UFO sightings all over the place, including close encounters with pilots. But, of course, he, who to me, I don't know about you guys, does not seem like the kind of person that would concoct a huge story. Well, he was photographed there. He was interviewed there. He was there. It was proven to be there. And he was one of the witnesses. Of course, there was an entire village of people there, a lot of them speak Turkish, that are probably still around, that all witnessed this happened, and it was going on for 3 years. And it was all video. A lot of it was videotaped on mini DVD cassette, which was analyzed by an institution within the government of Turkey. Turkey's a very friendly Muslim country to us. It's sort of a dangerous place to be now, but I just wanted to ask you, and let me get to my question. This whole series of events, Roger Lear described with Knapp that there wasn't any lighthouses in the water, no boats, no oil containers or anything. It was just open ocean. And nobody's been able to really come up with any explanation that really makes any sort of sense. And I'd be the first one to say, well, you know, this has got to be a fake, because there's, of course, most videos these days are fakes, but this is just different. But my question to you is, before he passed away, and maybe George, you can discuss it, did you have any time to ask him, or did he talk to you about what he encountered there? Because to him, it was a big deal, and he wanted people to know about it.
Well, we had a show about it, and but I never talked to him in person. Maybe Jeremy did. Jeremy, you ever talk to Roger?
I did. I mean, I talked to him a lot in person, but specifically
about the Turkey UFO?
Yeah, specifically about that event. It did impact him. I mean, hearing him talk about it, they borrowed this special lens that, you know, a guy said, oh, look over there. They end up filming it. It is one of the most astounding video, you know, pieces of footage that where you get the backstory and you see this object. I mean, they had a really special lens that day, so I know it did impact him. But look, the seeker is the finder. When you look up, when you are looking for these things, they end up appearing. This phenomenon, it seems to play upon your consciousness. As far as I can tell, and Jacques Vallée has studied this a lot, that there is a cycle and there is a pattern to these sightings. It has something to do with awareness and, frankly, just looking up. This is happening now. It's happening everywhere. If we take our eyes off the phones and look up, you're going to see something. Give it time.
Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it. We mentioned earlier in the program that we had a call from somebody who was on the Nimitz during the time that this weird activity happened. I have no idea if this guy saw anything or heard anything, but he's on our first-time caller line. Trevor is calling in from Phoenix. Hey, Trevor, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you, sir?
Thank you for calling in. So did you hear about this thing during the time it was happening?
No, I was. I'm actually was stationed on the Nimitz from 02 to 05. So I was I worked with the air radar, so I watched this object all morning long, basically. Basically, you'd sit at the radar, and you would just, you know, you would mark the contacts, and you would see what's going on around your operating area. And at that time, we were doing what they call JTFX, which is like exercises, war games and stuff. And I kept seeing in the northwest corner of this operating box, blipping in and out, you know, all my 8 hours on my watch. And so I was curious about it, brought it up on my watch. And it's nothing. I'm like, but it's something, because it was going on for a long period of time. And with my experience, you understand, you know what I mean, what you see. So anyway, I did a pass down at the end of my watch to a gentleman that deals with communicating with the F-18s, and I told him, hey, check this area out, watch this, and maybe you guys want to do something about it. Well, I went off watch, went down to my berthing, you know, do what we do, and I got a phone call. And sure enough, ran up, and they had the video.
Oh.
And I watched the video, and I knew, and I didn't literally run, because you're not allowed to run on the ship, but it was incredible, and I knew I only had a short amount of time to watch this thing. So I get up there, and I'm sitting there watching with all the other officers and a couple of seamen, and it was quite incredible, to be honest. I've never seen anything like it in my life.
So what is everybody thinking? What are the possibilities of what it is? Is anybody saying it?
We knew it was a UFO. Yeah, when you watch the video, what you could see it was, just a saucer type, something like that. It wasn't clear as day, you know, because the F-18 is recording it, because they have a camera underneath the nose of the plane. And so, we're just sitting there watching it, and one of the officers started analyzing it, and we started putting in slow-mo, you know, like freezing the frames and going frame by frame on the computer. And I mean, you could see the thing just like skip time or space. I don't know what you want to call it, but man, it was mocking F-18s, and then boom, it was gone. And you could see where the space and time were. This thing, nothing. I mean, it was incredible. They couldn't even put a number of G's on it. It was insane. I'll never forget that day.
Were you Were you debriefed? Was anybody else debriefed or told we don't talk about this?
Nope. It's when you guys were talking about that tonight, I was thinking about it. I'm like, we never debriefed. And I mean, I would tell you a little more, but I don't want to say it over the radio. But they probably shouldn't have posted it the way they did. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
All of us that had a certain type of clearance shouldn't have seen it, but we did see it because some people had access, whatever. So, but it was pretty incredible. So I had about 15 minutes to watch that thing, and bam, it's gone.
Jeremy, you have a question for Trevor?
Yeah, definitely. Trevor, I would highly encourage you to reach out to me through my website, extraordinarybeliefs.com. Write me an email personally. I'd like to correspond with you. I feel like you're very lucky to have seen it. I wonder which day it was that you saw it, was between the 10th and the 14th. I believe you're talking about the exact footage that has just been pushed out this morning publicly. But if you can reach out to me, there's a number of things I'd like to talk with you about. I'm in touch with a number of individual prime witnesses to this event, and I think that every piece of the puzzle is important. I think that's very cool you saw it, and as you said, you knew it was a UFO. It's not something that was in question. It was not ours.
I'll tell you what, Trevor, if you want to leave your number with Donna, We'll be in touch. Man, I can't thank you enough for calling in. That's a great story.
Thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
You guys have a good night.
You too,
Trevor. Be in touch. Thank you. Joe on the wildcard line in the Bronx. Hey, Joe.
Hey, George. How are you?
All right. What's on your mind?
I wanted to ask Jeremy. Now, earlier he mentioned the element that was found in patient 17's leg was of a form of nickel, I believe you referred to it as an extraterrestrial element 64. Do I have that right?
Not exactly. There were 36 different elements within the sample. We specifically looked at the isotopic analysis of both the zinc and the copper. We knew that it wasn't meteorite because of the ratios of nickel to iron. The object was primarily iron, so it was not meteorite. So maybe that's where you got confused, but it was 36 different elements, and we looked at the isotopes of zinc and copper, and the zinc 64 is off the charts, non-terrestrial.
Okay, can I ask you this then? How long did patient 17, or how long did they figure that he had this metal in his leg, and how is it that his health was not affected prior to it being removed?
So we know that it was inside his body for a minimum of 10 years because he had severe pain, which you'll see in the film. He describes that, and then he had an X-ray, and they showed an object, a foreign body, that was more dense than bone. But he didn't think that this had anything to do with his abductive experiences, nor would he tell his GP about that. So he just went on with his life. Then it was removed. Now, how it didn't leach out or give any kind of toxification to the body, I had a talk with a toxicologist who just happened to be sitting next to me one day, and we discussed that. And essentially, if the body produces the ability to encapsulate something, you can have a piece of lead or even a bullet in your brain. I mean, there's a famous story of a man with a bullet in his brain, that lived his whole life out. So you can have foreign objects in your body, even lead, and your body will do its best not to allow you to get sick from this. So we don't know exactly how this works. We just know the object was in there. He didn't have any ill effects from it, and then it was removed.
Thank you.
So
very
a lot of
much,
folks on.
Jeremy.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it. We got a lot of folks on the phones with some interesting topics, but I don't want to go to a call and then have to go to the break. I'm just still reacting to the call we just had there, Jeremy. That's a pretty big deal.
Big deal. And George, I'm running into this a lot. as I contact people, I mean, I have a lot of friends who are actually on deployment that I didn't know, and they didn't know that they were on deployment on the case that I was looking at because I couldn't talk to them about it. But I had friends on that deployment, close friends. So I'm not surprised that out of the millions and millions of listeners tonight, there are more people out there that didn't pick up the phone. And that's what's important. If you know anything about this case, if you know some of the fishermen who were identified in a recent article as their boats being out there at that time, reach out to me and let's look at this together. Let's try.
All right, we're going to go to a break. We'll be back with more of your calls for Jeremy Corbell. We're talking with Jeremy Corbell about his film projects, including Patient 17, little discussion of the Tic Tac UFO, Bob Lazar, Tom DeLonge, a lot of people on the phones. We'll get right to them right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Our final segment with filmmaker Jeremy Corbell. We go back to the phones, the wild card line, Thomas in La Jolla. Hey, Thomas. Good morning.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call. Jeremy, sure. Fascinating research you're doing in filmmaking. You know, Jeremy, concerning the Tic Tac incident, we're very focused on photographic evidence. But when you have a carrier strike group like the Nimitz, you know, outside of San Diego, California, there's several forms of electromagnetic surveillance going on simultaneously to protect the strike group and to protect the aircraft carrier. You have satellite, you have aerial reconnaissance, you have usually a couple of submarines with a strike group like that. So you have fairly intense underwater sonar. You have within 1,000 miles of the coast, of the West Coast at least, underwater sensors that can pick up, you know, boomers, so to speak, you know, foreign submarines that could possibly carry cruise missiles, etc. What I'm saying, this is a friendly question here. It seems like if there was a Freedom of Information Act request on the electromagnetic surveillance at the time, such as satellite surveillance, it could reveal far more of what was happening, not only with this UFO, but also the underwater submarine object that was recorded near the Nimitz. And I was wondering if anybody's ever thought of, you know, a FOIA request for what was happening electromagnetically, you know, from satellites, underwater sensors, aerial.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Thomas. That's a good point. Jeremy, do you know if that's part of the known database or is that even accessible via FOIA?
Right. So he makes a really good point on everything that he said, and I highly encourage people to do FOIAs. There have been FOIAs that have been filed on this event, but the information that is received back is dependent upon classification. So FOIA is this thing that we think is so powerful, but more and more we're finding with different changes in terminology, that's why I want to drill into people, AAV, anomalous aerial vehicle. When they change terminology or things are classified, our ability to get them through FOIA is greatly reduced. It is something we should do, we must do on this case. I encourage people who do that regularly to get into this case with that. But yes, there was a lot of detection of these objects. A lot of people know about this. That's why I'm hopeful. But FOIA is not the only answer.
Thanks. Appreciate that call. We're going west of the Rockies, Wayne in Washington. Hey, Wayne.
Good evening, gentlemen.
What's on your mind?
In viewing the jumbo viewing screens inside Iron Mountain at Space Command, I noticed that everything on there that was in space and around our space viewed from satellites was watched very carefully by Space Command, and everything was abbreviated as to what it was, whether it was a satellite, a dead satellite, space junk. And they had an abbreviation on what I could count to be at least a dozen, if not two or three dozen, because I didn't see all the screens, because there was a 360-degree screen room. what they called at the time ASCs, and that stood for alternate spacecraft. So we see these things coming in and out of our atmosphere all the time. And as Colonel Corso said, we can tell the good ones from the bad ones, and we've got craft that take the bad ones out.
Wait, are you saying that you worked for Space Command?
No, sir. No, sir. Oh. I'm saying that I saw these screens on a documentary. This is between 6.5 and 8 years ago. It was either on History Channel or Discovery Channel, but it was on Space Command, and they allowed them to go in there and tape all of this, and they showed it. And it was shocking to me that they revealed what they did at the time.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Well, yeah, that's amazing. I guess they figured nobody knew what it stood for.
I don't know. But, you know, just to give another realm of thought to this, as the book says, you know, there's nothing known to the sun, you know, almost 4,000 years ago, after the Great Deluge, and the oldest book that we know of that was written, Job said, all good things come from the Pleiades. And, of course, good things are godly things. And that's where God resides, whether it's in our dimension or in another dimension, I can't tell. But that is a long way away. It's one of the closest star systems at 433 light years. But there was a being there that was sent from there to Earth, and he came in 4 minutes. And I worked it out to be at about 56 million, well, actually closer to 57 million warp.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Wayne, for that observation. Jeremy, I'd imagine there's all kinds of sensor information, satellite information. I mean, as Jacques Vallée has said, I mean, it's the government, it's the military that has that kind of equipment. Of course, they've got that information somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've talked to pilots who've said they have, from time to time, been the UFO. I mean, it's like this is a known phenomenon within the United States government, governments around the world, and our intelligence communities. It reminds me of the revelations from Gary McKinnon talking about non-terrestrial officers. So there are acronyms and ways to look at this, and there's a lot going on. But, yeah, I find this highly fascinating, what he said about alternate spacecraft. But again, this is just, this phenomenon is real. We know this. We deal with this. We saw that in the DeLong announcement last week. You know, I'm rooting for him and what he's doing. More information that comes out, the better we'll be off. Inch by inch, life's a cinch. Yard by yard, life is hard.
Thanks, Wayne, for the call. I'll come back to the topic of whistleblowers toward the end of the program, but we got a couple of people hanging on for a while. Justin in California on the wild card line. Hey, Justin.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call, and thank you for interviewing Bob Lazar. I attempted to do so, actually did meet him in Las Vegas with his buddy, was trying to convince him to do some video interviews to follow up on George's interviews of him. We had contacted Bob through John Blair, and so when I met him, I was discussing with his work to extricate the power generating unit from the sport model. But one thing I never got around to asking them, of course, Bob and his buddy did not agree to do video interviews, so I did not have a complete interview. So I'm wondering if you ever covered interviewing Bob about how the control systems work on the power generator, which was the antimatter reactor. In other words, he was charged with another person from EG&G at the time to remove the device from the sport model, fire it up, and try to re-engineer it or figure out a way to re-engineer it. That's what Bob's, you know, story, what his job was at the time. So I'm wondering, as far as his task to try to do that, was he able to complete this task that he was brought into Area 51 for? And how was this unit fired up once it was removed from the sport model? And how was the sport model controlled in terms of its control?
Let's ask Jeremy that, because I, you know, my interviews with Bob were 28 and 25 and 26 years ago. So I know we covered that topic. I just don't remember the technical specifics that he answered to. So, Jeremy, did you get into that?
Absolutely. That's what's so cool about being able now to do this movie with and for Bob, really, is because these types of specific questions will be answered. First of all, he was never tasked to remove the power source. That was removed for him. It was in the lab when he went in there. Essentially, he talked about it being powered on and powered off. It was a resonance machine. It didn't have these fine-tuned controls, and it was an impossible job. With the material science alone we have today, we could not replicate what he was given. Not even talking about the super heavy elements, element 115 that you need to power this device. It was an impossible task.
Thank you, Justin. Appreciate the call. Nancy, east of the Rockies in Arkansas. Hey, Nancy. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
What's on your mind?
Well, I once upon a time, I lived in Lubbock, Texas, and it was 1975, I think, or maybe it was 76, but we came home from school and we came out in the evening and we saw a number of ships in the air, and they did some pretty amazing things, and they traveled in a triangular format, and they were pretty much triangular ships, and they zipped across from one side of the horizon to the other. They did what looked like acrobatics. Over several days in the evening, they appeared, and hundreds of us from our block, we were over off of 45th in Memphis and Lubbock, we came out and watched them, and more people every night. And, of course, we called Reese Air Force Base to ask if they were doing anything, and we were told no, and we just dealt with that. And I thought it was funny as I got older, given that it went on for so many nights, and it culminated in what looked like three ships that went in separate directions and then rapidly came back in one direction and appeared to collide with one another and then just vanish. And then that was the last we saw of them, except there was no debris. You know, there was nothing. And years later, I was reading, I believe the gentleman's name is Bob Hoskins. He writes about UFOs. Somebody gave me one of his books, and in his book, he talked about the Lubbock Lights, and I got really excited, and I thought, well, good, somebody's going to talk about it. But it turned out it was 25 years earlier, also at the end of August, also for a series of nights, also over Lubbock. It sounded like it was the exact same phenomenon, only nobody's ever written about it, and I've always been curious as to if anybody's ever researched it, and it seemed odd that it had happened. It's such a cyclical, you know, I don't know, but
well, actually, the Lubbock lights are pretty. Lubbock lights are pretty famous, Nancy. There's been quite a bit written about it. I'm guessing you're talking about Bud Hopkins' book. He'd written several books about abduction phenomena, but included a lot of UFO cases. The lights of Lubbock, though, don't act like what you're describing. That's pretty spectacular. Jeremy, any comments?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you witnessed a mass sighting with multiple eyewitnesses, and I encourage you to reach out to me so I can see what I can do to help find out more about this recent or more recent sighting that you had. You know, UFOs are a part of what we call the phenomenon, which is a catch-all term for this apparent display, and it's been with us since the beginning of recorded human history. But when you get opportunities like this, where you have multiple witnesses, you know the dates, that's something we can look into. So I encourage you to reach out to me.
Thank you, Nancy. Appreciate it. On the wild card line, Jimmy in South Dakota. Hey, Jimmy, good morning.
Good morning, George. How are you?
I'm doing well. How's it going?
Good. Good. Say, my comment and question is for you and your guest. I'm in awe here about this Project Roswell and Area 51. Now, I've heard a lot about that in the past, and I grew up knowing that there was some information about it. But I'm still confused. Is there still an ongoing investigation on both these projects, or is it just non-existent anymore?
Well, it seems like about once a month a new book comes out about Roswell. There are a lot of folks who are devoted to trying to nail that down. In the UFO community, there is a great deal of disagreement about specifics on Roswell, where the crash was, when it was exactly, whether there's one crash or two, whether bodies or not. Multiple versions of the story, and yes, a lot of people are still working on it. As for Area 51, that's It's an ongoing investigation as well, but I'm not sure that anybody's going to get anywhere. It sort of culminated in 1989 when we did some stories about Bob Lazar, who didn't actually work at Area 51. He worked at a place called S4, south of Groom Lake, the Area 51's main base. And he had said that he had worked on flying saucers from somewhere else, taking them apart to figure out how they worked, and they were stored in hangars built into the side of a mountain. It's kind of a long story to tell now if you haven't heard it, but there's a lot of information you could probably find to get caught up on Jeremy's website. Jeremy?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, there's a lot of history that we have here. I am excited because the UFO phenomenon has not slowed down since those big cases. So getting a case handed to you on a silver platter like the Tic Tac 2004 Nimitz case, if anybody out there knows more about this, reach out to us. Or if you know about other Tic Tac cases or cases that involve this kind of description, because there were more.
Thanks, Jimmy. We'll try to get one more call in. Elizabeth in Wyoming on the wild card line. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Hey. Did not think I was going to get on here.
There you are.
Crazy. Biggest thing that happened in Wyoming for a minute. So what is your guys' theory like on black holes? Like, what do you think that is in general? Like, what do you think it is?
Black holes?
I have, like, a completely different, like, theory, and it all kind of wraps around with this, the Tic Tac thing. And
well, black holes are a collapsed star where the gravity is so dense even light can't escape. Where are you heading with this?
Well, my theory is, okay, remember that movie that just came out? It was called, like, Arrival or something, and it was, like, the aliens came here, and they're like, we're going to do a symbiotic relationship, you know, which it means, like, you do something for us, we do something for you, and then we live harmoniously. And it must happen. Well, just like in chemistry, like, elements and atoms, they, like, come in, and they bond, and, you know, all this stuff, and they're sucked together by, like, this electricity or this magnetic pull that we just can't really put any kind of science to it besides just labeling it what it is. But we really don't know what the pole is. What if microcosmos, macrocosmos, what if we were doing that, like, with our solar systems? What if, like, our orbitals, you know, like, I don't know if you know anything about chemistry, but orbital shells, valence shells, they have the electrons on them. What if that was, like, somehow, like, our planets? And, like, so we are really just becoming, like, black holes aren't going anywhere. They're becoming something else. Like, it's not a... Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, they're not...
Yeah, I think so. It's a very exotic explanation. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to have time to get to it, but thank you for calling, Elizabeth. I appreciate it. And thanks to all the other callers as well. Jeremy, one more... I don't know if you have a comment on Elizabeth's theory about black holes.
Just that, you know, we need to investigate the unexplained and not explain the uninvestigated. You know, all of this is fascinating. Science is catching up. We're living in just an incredible time of life. And, you know, look, my life is like the modern-day Twilight Zone with a twist of Twin Peaks, except everything I'm experiencing is real, and that's because I'm just looking for it. So I just encourage people, like the last caller, you know, keep thinking, put information out, and try to learn as much as you can. Science is catching up. We live in a very mysterious universe.
And you know, we've talked about whistleblowers and people coming forward in this program. It's important to be, you know, be on guard, to be careful about the kind of information that comes forward. You should ask questions about it. People should ask questions about Lazar, about Tom DeLonge, good, healthy questions, but you want to keep an open mind. Jeremy Corbell, filmmaker, will check out your stuff. Extraordinary. We'll check out your website. We got links on the Coast to Coast AM website. And we're glad to have you here.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, and I look forward to learning more. Thank you, George.
All right. And thanks to my colleagues there at Coast, Nathan Staton, Donna Walker, Dan Galani, our webmaster tonight, Lex Lonehood, Chris Boros, our producer. George Norrie's back tomorrow. I'll be back next Sunday night with my guest, Dave Politis. Good night.